The blade! The blade emerging from underneath the ring!
Who is it?
The blade! And the butcher! The butcher not far behind emerging!
Blade and the butcher?
The butcher and the blade!
These guys know exactly what to do. Who sent these people here? We've never seen these two men on AEW before, have we?
We have not seen them before. The Butcher and the Blade.
We've not seen them before? Then how the fuck do you know who they are?
Well, now we know who brought them here. It's the Bunny, Allie. Got the Butcher, the Blade, and the Bunny.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Oh my god, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Fight me?
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
The Butcher and the Blade. You know, even Jim Ross said on Twitter that neither one of them, not him, not Excalibur, were supposed to know who those guys were when they came up from underneath the ring on Wednesday. We weren't supposed to know. None of us, is what he tweeted. And then somebody said it was very weird how Excalibur would know who they are. And JR said, agreed. So even he realized how stupid it all was and threw his partner under the bus. This is episode 628. Of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here, post-Thanksgiving edition, for the first day of December, December 1st, 2019. I am the Solid Monster. Hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving. It's all recovered from their food comas. Everyone's gained about 10 to 15 pounds. At least I feel like I have in these last few days. See, it only gets worse now, right? Because you're going into the holidays in December. Yeah, like in our office, people bring cookies. One person gives everybody their own tin of Christmas cookies and treats, and, you know, you can't turn that down. So then you end up eating all of that. Then I'm going on this cruise in January. I know, what a horrible thing. But I will not look at the scale for a few months. WWE is airing Starrcade 2019, tonight on the network for the very first time. They've done their own Starrcade show, I think, each of the last 2 years. They basically take a house show. Tonight it's in Duluth, Georgia, and they convert it into what they call a Starrcade event. They're trying to sell tickets. And this is the first time they're airing this on the network. It has a one-hour runtime, which is the perfect length for a wrestling show, starting at 7 Eastern. Rusev takes on Bobby Lashley in a last man standing match. So their first match together is a last man standing match. Maybe that will build to a straight singles match on pay-per-view. We have a fatal four-way for the WWE Women's Tag Team titles. Asuka and Kairi Sane defend against the Raw Women's Champion Becky Lynch and Charlotte. Sasha Banks and Bayley. And the team of Alexa Bliss and Nikki Cross. Alexa is back. She made her big return on SmackDown Friday night. So that's the other match that's been announced. They've also announced a Kevin Owens show segment with the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. Got to get Ric Flair on Starrcade in some way. Now, I believe Owens is supposed to wrestle AJ Styles on the show tonight. I don't know if they'll have time to fit that match in. My guess would be no. It's possible. But those are the only things that have been announced. It's a one-hour show. You can't expect them to be doing much. So if you don't get enough wrestling during the week, now you've got Starrcade, a glorified house show airing tonight on the network. A lot of people have cashed in their Audible trial on the new Mayor Kane book, which is now out. Pre-orders are done. Now you can just order it. You can listen to it in real time. One of our listeners, Alberto from Laredo, Texas, he sent me an email saying that he got the book with my Audible code, our Audible link, and was already through 5 chapters of the book. He says it's great. And actually, he suggested that I do a review like I did for one of Jericho. I had reviewed one of Chris Jericho's books. Might have been the second one, which is still up on YouTube many, many years ago. So he suggested I do something similar for the Mayor Kane book. I haven't gotten to it yet. I've been so busy. I would consider it, though. It sounds like a really interesting book. But anyway, that's one reader endorsement. See for yourself for free. Go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. Sign up for 30 days and get the book for free. Narrated by Mayor Jacobs himself. If you want to become a PayPal VIP, you know the drill. Go to thesolomonster.com. PayPal button's on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on the show, like these fine folks, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Yvonne Bruiser Balick, Killshot Keith Hart, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman, Halistick, Raymond the Mountie Medina. Man, I haven't heard Raymond's name in a while. Hope he's doing well. The Maniac Moderator, Jeff Lipman, and Big Papa Slop, Dan Leopold. Hope Natalie is doing well. So thank you to all the folks who took the time to donate here this holiday week. Steve Sitko is a listener. He's been a listener of this podcast for almost a decade of my 12 years doing this show. His wife, Liz, is the mother of four, special ed teacher for children with autism. She is raising money to run in the Boston Marathon next year. All money raised will go to the Boston Science Museum. She has a large goal to reach, so every little bit helps, even if just a dollar. Here's what I need you to do. Go to LizRunsBoston.com. You're going to see a giant circle on the front page that says make a contribution. You may have to set up a free account or just log in via Facebook. And it will take you directly to the GoFundMe where you can donate. So that's LizRunsBoston.com if you would like to support. And speaking of friends of the podcast, we have another friend of the podcast. John Krauser has a 3-run show at DeMatt Theater at the Second City in Chicago this month, including this Saturday. It's a show about the world's worst magician, the Brain Freak, who's been given his own holiday special as he prepares to wow the crowd with a mix of magic, improv, and complete chaos. There's only a few tickets left for Saturday's show that's coming up on December 7th, starting at 8:30 p.m. That's local time in Chicago. Visit secondcity.com and choose Chicago as your location to find the page, and you can buy your tickets there. This is a man in John who is pursuing his dream by doing this. So this is a big deal for him, and it's very cool to see, and now he needs our help, so let's all band together if you are local and you think you can make it out to go and show your support. So all you Windy City freaks out there, go see the Brain Freak for his holiday special. I'll be talking more about this in the weeks to come. He's got 3 different shows coming up. This Saturday, December 7th, beyond the Brain Freak, here in New York, House of Glory celebrates its 9th anniversary with HOG9 at the NYC Arena in Jamaica, Queens. And what a main event we've got lined up for you. The HOG Tag Team Champions, Pentagon and Phoenix, the Lucha Bros. Yes, they are still the House of Glory Tag Team Champions. They've never lost those titles. They're going to be in attendance. And first of all, they're actually going to have a busy week ahead of them because each one of the Lucha Bros is wrestling in their own singles matches this Wednesday on AEW Dynamite. Phoenix is taking on Trent Barretta, and Pentagon is taking on Christopher Daniels. Then on Saturday, after they beat the hell out of those two, they'll be back in HOG to defend their tag team titles against the returning Private Party, Mark Quinn and Isaiah Cassidy. Also coming back next weekend to House of Glory. That's going to be a pretty insane match. The Amazing Red will also be making his return. Meet and greets with Nature Boy Ric Flair coming off his Starrcade appearance tonight. And Charlie Caruso making her first appearance for House of Glory. Chuck is coming to HOG as well. So you never know what you're going to see. Look, I called a Street Fighter battle with Low Ki on the show last month. And he'll be there on Saturday as well. He's going to be wrestling Masada, the deathmatch legend. And maybe when that's over, maybe he'll play him in Mario Kart. You never know. Anyway, you can get your tickets now at hogwrestling.net, and I will see you all there. And before we get into all the wrestling stuff, I had some people ask me about this, and I wanted to talk about it. So I figure I'll talk about it up front. I have been waiting for quite some time to see this new Martin Scorsese movie, The Irishman, which came out, officially it dropped on Netflix this past week. It has been out in theaters for a few weeks now, limited run. But I did not want to go to the theater and sit through a 3.5 hour movie. So, came to Netflix this past week, and I watched it with my brother the other day. We sat down, we were going to watch it in parts, we ended up watching the whole thing straight through. It's Scorsese's latest, it's like a gangster flick for Netflix, and I made the right choice in watching it at home. You should never sit in a movie theater for 3.5 hours, I don't think, for anything. You know, the last time I made that mistake was for The Watchmen. See, I see now they have a TV series based off of it. I hope it's more easily digestible than that movie was. Maybe I'm in the minority on this. Maybe the movie was widely praised. I thought it was a bore. That was me. I just remember thinking, man, when is this thing going to be over? I couldn't wait for it to end. So that was a horrible experience for me. I never felt that way about this film. I really enjoyed it. You got Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci were all standouts. And how many really great, let's be honest here, I mean, how many really great De Niro or Pacino movies have there been in the last 15 years? Not very many. Until now. Pesci in particular, I haven't seen him in anything new in years. He basically retired about 20 years ago after one of those last Lethal Weapon movies. He just wanted to go do other things, and he retired. And he may have done a small role here and there in the last 20 years, but he largely just disappeared, like Rick Moranis. Remember him? Ghostbusters and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And then he just said, I'm done. I retire. I don't think he's done anything since then on a big scale. So that's kind of what Pesci did. He just vanished. He disappeared. And he did a whole bunch of movies back then. You know, the Home Alone movies, My Cousin Vinny. He did that movie, The Super, the Lethal Weapon stuff. And then just poof, gone. Of course, you know, you think of the other movies as well. You know, Casino and all that kind of stuff. He, to me, was the real standout here in this movie. I thought he was incredible. And he played a different kind of role than you're used to seeing him in. Much more reserved. I mean, he's older, so I mean, he can probably only do so much. What is he, 70-something years old now? Much more reserved. I thought he was fantastic. And he just did not want to, even for this, get back into acting. De Niro had to talk him into doing this film. And he said that De Niro probably, he turned De Niro down about 50 times. 50 times De Niro pitched this guy in doing the film. And every time Pesci would say, go fuck yourself. And De Niro would just come back and keep pestering him and asking him until finally he just broke the guy down and he agreed to do it. But I think Pesci or Pacino could win the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. That's how good these two were in this movie. The one thing that was really sad, I thought, you know, you watch this movie and they're all in their 70s, in some cases bordering on 80 years old, right? Everybody's older now. Even back then, they were older. It just wasn't like they were young men back then when they did Goodfellas and Casino and all those movies. So now they're just really old. And it sucks watching these guys get old. Could say the same thing about wrestlers. I'm going to talk about The Undertaker here in a little bit in the interview he did with Stone Cold. And talking about injuries and age and when to give it up and all that. It's sad, you know, when you watch these guys, whether it's on TV and wrestling or in movies and film. And these are, you know, some of the greats at what they do. In some iconic role, and then they just get to an age where you see them on screen, and it's just almost sad to see. Some guys age gracefully, others not so much. And to me, one of the saddest moments in this film, and I'm not going to, you know, give too much away here, but one of the sad moments for me, you'll know it when you see it. There's a kind of like a fighting scene of sorts early in the movie involving De Niro, where he beats somebody up. And this is supposed to be a scene with his younger self, because they use CGI for like at least half the movie to make him and Pesci and all these guys look younger, which is very weird. But that's what they did. They didn't have younger people play them. They played themselves, I don't know, what, 20 years, 20, 30 years younger? It's very weird. And even in this scene when he was supposed to be younger, you're watching De Niro, like, kicking this guy. And just the way that he's moving, it's like, ugh. It's so sad. It's so sad. But you know what this felt like to me watching this? It really felt like the end of an era. It really did. It felt like the end of an era for these three. This felt like the closing chapter, in many ways, of three legendary careers. Maybe the last great film that we'll ever see any of them in. I also counted no less than four familiar faces from The Sopranos. I won't spoil who. You'll know them when you see them. And Todd from Breaking Bad has a role in this as well, that little weasel. But on the whole, if you're wondering, you know, I'm thinking about seeing it, it's so long, what'd you think of it? I thought it was really, really good. I enjoyed it. It is a very long movie. You might have to watch it in two or three parts. Or you can just, you know, fix a meal, order in a pizza, grab some beer, sit back and watch the whole thing. I mean, look, got 3 hours of Raw every Monday night. I think you can sit through a one-time Scorsese film on Netflix for 3.5 hours. But yes, very, very good film, and I enjoyed it. I watched that instead of SmackDown, in fact. I did catch up later on with SmackDown, but nothing was going to stop me. You give me the choice between SmackDown or a Scorsese film with De Niro and Pacino and Harvey Keitel and Joe Pesci. Who else is in this? There's a whole bunch of people in this movie. You know what I'm going to pick. Survivor Series 2019 was last Sunday. Final Twitter poll results, over 4,600 votes. 77% thumbs up, 23% thumbs down. I thought it was a thumbs up show on the whole. I liked both elimination matches, probably more so the men's. And the Adam Cole, Pete Dunne NXT Championship match stole the show. I mean, there's no debate about that. I thought the main event was just a giant bore. Although I was pleasantly surprised to see Shayna Baszler pick up the clean win, tapping Bayley out in the main event. Vince McMahon was said to have hated it, something that we can actually agree on. I just did not like the match. It was not worthy of being in that main event spot. It felt very flat. And they should have done a better job of laying things out and realizing that that might happen without some kind of big climactic finish, that might happen. So I just thought it was largely a bore, but on the whole, I did enjoy the show. Now, one of the stories coming out of the pay-per-view was the no-show by Mauro Ranallo, who was scheduled to work some Survivor Series matches, including some Survivor Series matches with Corey Graves, which would have been very awkward. He showed up to the building, and I'll tell you why in a second. He showed up to the building with his friend Frank Shamrock, and then he left at some point before the show began. And over the course of that day, earlier in the day, I believe, he deactivated his Twitter account. Now, on TV during the show, they had Michael Cole cover for him, claiming that Mauro wasn't there. He was supposed to be. He wasn't there he was so emotional the night before during that War Game show that he lost his voice. And they were hopeful, you know, we'd see him Wednesday night back in the saddle on NXT, which, by the way, he was not. Because, you know, when I lose my voice, I always delete my Twitter account. Makes sense. Of course, that was a lie. It happened after Corey Graves tweeted some shade at Mauro the night before. He was basically, without even naming Mauro by name, saying that he talks too much, and because of that, we never get to hear Nigel McGuinness. We've got this former Ring of Honor World Champion on commentary, and we've got a WWE Hall of Famer in Beth Phoenix, but you would never know it. So he tweeted that out during the TakeOver show. Now, Corey Graves, he knows what Mauro Ranallo, his story is, and what he's dealt with, and what he continues to work through. Serious mental health struggles, bipolar. He's been very open about all of this stuff. And coming into the weekend, Mauro even said publicly that he was worried. You know, he knew that he would be working. This was his first main roster show, I believe, since the JBL debacle when he left the SmackDown booth and he ended up going to NXT. So Graves tweeted anyway, because Corey Graves is a dick. Now, if he has an issue with somebody who works in the same company, and you know that this person may be sensitive to these types of things, then you take it up with him personally. And if you don't really mean it, and you want to try to shoot your own wrestling angle, which is what he now claims he was trying to do, and I think he's full of shit when he says that also, I think that's a cover. But that's what he claimed on his podcast. Well, I was just trying to, you know, stir things up and start some kind of controversy. Then at least let the other person know. Let him know, hey, listen, don't take what I'm about to tweet personally. Here's what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to stir things up, you know, between the brands. Just wanted to give you a heads up. He didn't do that. And after being called out on it, he doubled down on his stupidity. And he bashed Dave Meltzer. It's all Dave Meltzer's fault. I mean, I guess it was low-hanging fruit for him after Seth Rollins called out Meltzer last month, claiming he had spoken up at that talent meeting after the Saudi Arabia show. And in fact, Rollins said he never did. He never said a word. There was a talent meeting, but he never stood up and gave some kind of rah-rah speech. And when Meltzer learned that he had been fed this misinformation, he apologized. He apologized publicly to Seth Rollins. So he's sort of public enemy number one right now among the ranks of some of the talent in WWE. Easy target. So Corey decided to play the Meltzer card and said, "You have my number, you so-called journalist. Call me if you want the truth." Well, a few days later, Graves waited until his podcast dropped, his WWE podcast, to issue an apology, if you could call it that. He thought that his tweet was something that would stir up controversy and give him something to talk about on television or on his podcast. He said it may not have been the most professional way to go about doing things, but it was never meant to offend, disrespect, or disparage anybody. That was never his intention. And he said, if somebody took it that way, I apologize. Ah, yes. The old I'm sorry if you were offended apology, non-apology. I love those. That is not a real apology, by the way. If you don't want to apologize, don't apologize. Don't give some bullshit apology. If that's how you really feel, then don't say anything at all. It's not a real apology. That's about as disingenuous an apology as you can give. He said he didn't mean to cause anybody any undue stress, especially a coworker, and he apologized one more time before moving on to other topics. I'm still waiting for him to explain what was so false about Meltzer. I want to know what the big lie was that Meltzer reported that caused him to kind of lash out at him and go off on him the way that he did. He was very angry. He was posting 2, 3, 4 different things on Twitter about Dave. I'd like to know what was so false now that he's come out and apologized. I mean, look, I'm not the defender of all things Meltzer. He fucked up on that Rollins story, bottom line. But seems to me that he may be owed an apology too on this one. So Graves was an asshole. He only made things worse for himself by doubling down when all he had to do, when he saw that the heat was rising, all he had to do was say, "I fucked up. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Say I'm sorry tomorrow. I meant no ill will." And that's it. That's all he had to do. Instead of acting all defensive about it. We all make mistakes. We all say things we regret at one time or another. Those with class handle them the right way. Corey Graves did not handle this the right way. So draw from that your own conclusion on what that means. And here's the really egregious thing about it. On World Mental Health Day in October, I was going to say last month, it's December 1st now. But basically a month ago, month and a half ago. It was World Mental Health Day. And Corey Graves tweeted this. Because I saw this being shared around on social media, and I just thought this was too precious not to mention this here. "Until you have felt its power, it's difficult to understand depression and anxiety. It's very real and even worse without someone to lean on. Ask for help, or if someone close to you is suffering, please just listen. It might make all the difference." Maybe he ought to start taking his own advice. If you've never seen the Mauro Ranallo documentary, it's called Bipolar Rock and Roller. It gives you this great insight into his life and what he goes through on a daily basis. It's up right now. It's the whole full documentary is up for free on YouTube if you search for it. I encourage everybody to go watch it if you've never seen it before. And it made me even angrier when I saw it pop up on YouTube and I was watching back certain parts of it, because it had been a while since I saw it, and I was watching certain parts of it again, and it just made me angry. But it's really well done. Mauro was supposed to be back on NXT on Wednesday. He was not there. Tom Phillips filled in for him. Tom Phillips is really good and a more than capable replacement, but hopefully we will get Mauro back on TV this week. I watched the Broken Skull Sessions with Stone Cold Steve Austin interviewing The Undertaker. I thought it was fantastic, but there was so much ground left uncovered. I mean, they really need to make it, I think they need to make it a four-part or a five-part series, maybe even a six-parter. It ran over 90 minutes, or right around 90 minutes. On the podcast he did with Corey Graves, Austin said that he and Undertaker talked for 4 hours. So imagine how much stuff they still have that hasn't even been released yet. I want to see the other 2.5 hours that they recorded. And to show you how much they did not get into, the word Kane, I don't believe, was even mentioned once in those 90-plus minutes. They certainly did not get into the Kane character and the story. I don't even remember the word Kane, the name Kane, being mentioned a single time in the entire thing. Or if it was just a passing reference. You could do a whole hour on that alone. As big of a part of The Undertaker's career and character as that became, as Kane became. You know, did he have any reservations when he first heard that this was the angle they were pitching? They're going to introduce a new family member for him? And did he have any input into who would fill the role? I would be very interested to hear him talk about it. I've heard Kane talk about it before, including on the network. They did this great little half-hour-long documentary about Kane and his debut at Bad Blood over 20 years ago. But to get The Undertaker's insights on this, I think would be even more interesting. They didn't touch any of the Foley stuff, Hell in a Cell, which I was happy about because I feel like it's just been done to death. And again, there's been a documentary that WWE already did, one of these mini-docs, where they actually interviewed Undertaker by phone. So I've already heard his thoughts on the Hell in a Cell match with Mankind, but they didn't even get into that either. So just imagine all of the ground that was left uncovered. It's just this wide, just array of material that they could get so many more shows out of. And I think people would be willing to subscribe to the network to hear Undertaker talk about all this stuff because it's so incredibly rare for him to sit down like this in this kind of laid-back environment, you know, throwing back shots with Stone Cold and talking about all of these little stories. You know, he took 3 shots of Jack Daniels by my count. I was counting. Although, who knows how much more was consumed during those missing 2 hours. They may have done another 2 or 3. He said he doesn't drink much anymore, but when he does, clearly he's a Jack Daniels guy. I laughed out loud when he told the story of meeting Vince McMahon for the first time. And he got hit with... And I was very sad that he did not credit Hulk Hogan with basically discovering him. Have you heard that before? That's one of the stories that Hogan has told over the years. You know, that he was with Vince McMahon, and he told Vince McMahon about this guy. You got to bring this guy in. You know, he had him on the set for Suburban Commando. Remember Undertaker had a cameo in the movie Suburban Commando with Hogan? Even though I don't think the timeline exactly matches up with when he came in and when the movie, you know, was actually filmed, I'd have to go back and check. Hogan's the only person I've ever even heard hint at the idea that he had anything to do with Undertaker being brought in and discovered by Vince McMahon. I guess it's possible. It is at least possible. It's plausible. As much as McMahon and Hogan probably hung out doing God knows what back in the day, but as much as they were around each other, maybe Hogan did drop a comment about the guy. And The Undertaker never knew that Hulk Hogan played such an influential role in his career. I find it very hard to believe. It's hard to buy into anything that Hogan says, though, in some of the tall tales that he's told over the years. Anyway, Undertaker never once mentioned Hogan here. Shocking, I know. Did not give him any credit for being discovered by Vince McMahon. But Undertaker's telling this story about meeting Vince for the first time. And he's at Vince's house and he gets hit with the question, do you have any hidden talents? And he told them, well, you know, I'm a pretty good singer and I sing in the shower. And as soon as he said it, he immediately regretted it. Because this was during a time where they had some really ridiculous gimmicks in WWE. Not everybody, but most people had some kind of gimmick or some kind of character, whether it be the, I'm trying to put myself back in that time set, 1989, 1990, Red Rooster, Akeem the African Dream. Later on, you had like the Mountie. I mean, there's been so many, you know, gimmicks and characters over the years. So he's thinking, oh my God, I just made a huge mistake. And Vince said, oh, really? You know, you sing in the shower, huh? And Undertaker tells Austin, he goes, I'm thinking, oh, you screwed up, man. You're going to be shower boy now. Shower boy. Picture the Undertaker as shower boy. Coming to the ring with a fucking shower cap on his head. Spitting bars from ABBA's Dancing Queen into his hairbrush like it's a microphone. I laughed my ass off when he said that. And then, so he's sitting at home. Vince basically says, we don't have anything for you. And he's like, well, I'm fucked because I've already left, you know, WCW. I've already given my notice and I've left, assuming that, hey, I'm a big guy, 6'10". There's no way Vince McMahon's not going to want to do something with me. And there was either just no spot or there was not that there was no interest. I think it was a case where we might bring you in later on, maybe after WrestleMania. And he said, WrestleMania was still months away. I don't have a job. What am I going to do? So he's sitting at home and he's watching one of the syndicated shows on TV. And he sees that each week they start airing before Survivor Series, they start airing these vignettes of this giant egg that is going to hatch at the Survivor Series. And he starts thinking, his mind starts to play tricks on him. And he says, oh my God, they finally figured out what their big idea is going to be for me. They haven't told me yet, but I guarantee you that egg is for me. I'm going to be Eggman. And he had convinced himself that he was going to get the phone call any day now saying, hey, Mark, we got this idea for you and we want to put you in this giant egg and you're going to hatch at the Survivor Series and you're going to be the Eggman. And they're going to make me shave my head. They're going to make me shave my eyebrows. First of all, if there was ever going to be an Eggman, there's only one man who could have been the Eggman because he was literally, shaped like an egg. And I've always said this. King Kong Bundy. King Kong Bundy, if you just look at the guy, he looks like a giant egg. So if they were ever going to do an Eggman gimmick, he would be the only person for that role, which I'm sure he would never have agreed to. But yes, Undertaker was very worried about being Eggman, like he was from Sonic the Hedgehog or something. And so he had convinced himself of this. Shower Boy or Eggman? What would have been worse? I'm sure JBL would have been a very big fan of Shower Boy. Or back then, I guess it would have been Terry Garvin, but that's neither here nor there. I would recommend that you watch the full interview for yourself. You don't need me to recap every single part of it. There were some other highlights that I did want to just mention here from the interview. We got to see the original concept art, or some of the original concept art for the Undertaker character. Those are always fun to see. I don't know if they still have people internally who still do these for certain characters. I know WWE.com once ran concept drawings of the Max Moon character for Conan when he was coming in before he debuted and what that character would look like. They did them for Goldust. They did them for Kane. So they used to do these for characters all the time. There's a whole gallery of sketches right now that you can go see on WWE.com. for the Undertaker character. And some of these drawings, they're very detailed. And when I say detailed, I don't mean the actual illustrations. I mean, they have writing on the pages explaining the origins of the character, what this means, what this tattoo means. And you know, there was concept art in there where the Undertaker was wearing some kind of an amulet to the ring. And there was writing on the pages explaining the significance of the amulet and its origins. Really cool stuff that I had never seen before. I just typed in go into Google. All you gotta do is go to the Google machine, type in WWE.com, Undertaker concept art. And it was the first thing that came up when I searched for it. I couldn't find it on the main page, so I just did a search and boom, there it was. Undertaker talked about how hard it was at first because he was playing this undead zombie who no-sold everything. He had to intentionally slow himself down. So for all the criticism that he used to get about Undertaker moves, He no-sells everything, and he moves slowly, can't wrestle, all he does is lumber around the ring. Well, that was done by design, because he understood the character. Today, I mean, I hate to say it, but today, you would have, and I love the Luchasaurus to death. I'm going to use him as an example. But I love the Luchasaurus, and I think he's going to have big things in his future. He's going to be the AEW champion at some point, and I love the guy to death. But when you see a guy like that should not be doing crazy flips and dives out of the ring. I'm not saying he should just dumb his entire moveset down and do nothing exciting. But today, I feel like if The Undertaker was coming up, he'd almost have no choice, you know, as far as competing with all these other people. You would not have The Undertaker wrestling the same kind of style that he did 30 years ago. You know, when he recognized, okay, this is what the character should be. Slow movements, almost like a movie villain where he kind of creeps up on you and just really creepy, and then every now and then you bust out a big move. You bust out a flying, jumping clothesline to impress people. But he knew that character inside out. Today, if he came up, he'd have to be doing dives and cannonballs out of the ring. Undertaker would have to go up to the top rope and do some kind of trust dive out onto a pile of people outside on the floor. It would be a totally different vision. It would be a completely different incarnation of that character. And he would do it. He wanted to do it back then, but he had to tell himself, you can't do that. It doesn't match the character. It doesn't make any sense. You've got to slow down. So to hear him talk about that, I thought was very interesting. And also, you look at the later years of his career. And when that character evolved and changed, the stuff that he was doing in matches with Shawn Michaels where he was doing dives out of the ring, I just got done talking about that with Luchasaurus. Undertaker was doing that in the later part of his career, that's what I mean. You would have seen that at the beginning of his career. We got it at the end of his career, where he was doing crazy dives outside until he almost killed himself that one year at WrestleMania. Because that's just how things have evolved over time. But he cited Michael Myers from the Halloween movies. He cited Jason Voorhees as the characters that he tried to pattern himself after. And that was obvious because that's where the Undertaker zombie setup comes from. It came from Michael Myers in the original Halloween. He didn't say that, but that's where it came from. He did talk about his transition to the American Badass character in 2000. They even showed footage of his return at Judgment Day in 2000. I believe that was at the Louisville Gardens in Kentucky. You've never heard a Kentucky crowd so hot for anything in your entire life. Yeah, you think of hot crowds, people think of big Madison Square Garden crowd, big Chicago crowd. This is at the Louisville Gardens in the middle of the Attitude Era. And out comes The Undertaker, and you have never heard a reaction like this before. And they were sitting there watching this in studio and talking over it. They were narrating over it as they were watching the return, which was really cool. And I still say to this day, one of the most insane crowd reactions that I've ever seen to a return was at the end of that Iron Man match between Triple H and The Rock when The Undertaker rode down to the ring on that Harley Davidson and he cleaned house with about 30 seconds left in that Iron Man match. Now, he said he was supposed to come back in January. That was the story that had been reported at the time, that he was due back in January, possibly after the Royal Rumble, and right at the tail end of his training and his preparation to come back, he tore his pec. He had been out with a really bad groin injury going back to September. That's when they took him out of that six-pack challenge at Unforgiven. They replaced him with the British Bulldog. This was in September of 99. So that's how bad the injury was. They put him in the match and they had to take him out of the match. So January, he's all ready to come back and then boom, he tears his pec muscle. And so he ended up not coming back until May, which means he very likely would have had a match. It's almost all but guaranteed that The Undertaker would have had a match originally that year at WrestleMania. At WrestleMania 2000, he would have had a match. And it's always fun to do the whole what-if stuff. So for example, and Austin probably just didn't think of it. I might not have thought of it either if I was interviewing him, but I would have wanted to ask him and follow up on that. Because he's got a really good memory. One of the big takeaways from this is that The Undertaker remembers a lot of shit. You know, some guys don't remember anything. Or they don't remember dates and little details. And it would be totally understandable. The Undertaker has had probably thousands of matches. He's been wrestling for 30 years. 30 plus years. you go to Ric Flair and you ask him, hey, do you remember that match you had in Greensboro in 1986 on, it was a cold, windy night? Like, he's not going to fucking remember. He was going out after every show, drinking until the wee hours of the night, doing God knows what. Undertaker remembers a lot of stuff, and I would be curious to have followed up on that and said to him, well, you were supposed to come back in January. What was the plan? You know, did you know who you were going to work with going into WrestleMania that year? Maybe he didn't know. Maybe they hadn't worked that out yet. But that would have been a natural, you know, follow-up. I would have been very curious to hear his response, because you just, otherwise you play the what-if game. Well, what if he did come back? Who would he have wrestled that year? Who would he have had a match with at WrestleMania in 2000? And would that have been the end of the streak? Because this was before the streak stuff was really acknowledged on TV. So would it have been a match against the Big Show? Would Undertaker have maybe gotten Big Show's spot in that Fatal 4-Way main event, a McMahon in every corner, and it would have been Shane McMahon in the Undertaker's corner? If so, that almost surely would have been the end of the streak. But we'll never know. So I would have asked him about that. But Undertaker seems to... What's cool about when you listen to him speak, he does remember a lot of details about a lot of matches he had and backstage stories, goings-on behind the scenes. He got asked about that famous photo from the New Generation era, the back of the bus on a European tour with Diesel and Razor and Bret Hart. I think Bret was in the photo. Shawn Michaels was in the photo. I don't know, maybe Bret wasn't. I don't think Bret was. Bret was not in that photo. But Paul Bearer and Jerry Briscoe is there, and one of them, or both of them. Actually, I think Paul Bearer has a drink in his hand, and Jerry Briscoe has a cigar hanging out of his mouth. It's a famous photo. He talked about the photo. He remembers the photo. He remembers taking it. He remembers exactly where it was from. It was right before Hall and Nash were leaving to go to WCW. Austin... he did not ask Undertaker about his BSK, you know, the Bone Street crew that Undertaker had there with Yokozuna and Fatu and Kama and Savio Vega, and I think Henry Godwin might have been part of it. Or if they did get into it, it ended up on the cutting room floor. Maybe they got into it in the other 2 hours, or 2.5 hours that are missing. That would have been something I think that would be interesting to hear about. He told a funny story about closing down a hotel bar. This was in the late 90s with the band Cypress Hill, that ended with them up in Cypress Hill's hotel room and Sean Waltman dozing off on Undertaker's shoulder and then waking him up and saying, I think we're done here. He just looks and sees bodies laid out all over the room because they were drinking and smoking pot and everything. And they had heard that Undertaker, hey, you know, you're a big partier. Undertaker was going to go to his hotel room. It was, I think, the tail end of a tour. He was tired. He got somebody mouthed off, and he said, oh, okay, well, that's how it's going to be. So he stayed up and drank them all under the table, and there he is. He's in Cypress Hill's hotel room, and everybody's laid out, and Undertaker just wakes up. He nudges Waltman and says, hey, I think our job here is done. I think we're done. So that was a funny story. He really thought that was it after the end of an era match with Triple H at WrestleMania 28. He thought that was the end. And he said the same thing about the match with Roman Reigns at WrestleMania 33 when they put a picture up on the screen behind them of him standing in the ring. And Undertaker was not physically in his peak form. And he even said, he goes, his body was just beat to shit going into that match. And you see the shot of him in the ring, all of his gear. He took all of his gear off and left it right in the middle of the ring, and he left. He kissed his wife. He walked up the ramp. He went about midway up. Plume of smoke. He lowers down beneath the ramp. It's like he disappears into the depths of hell. The lights in the stadium go out. I was there for it. It was this great emotional moment where we all thought, this is it. Like, here I am. I'm in Orlando inside the stadium. I'm live at WrestleMania. This has been one long-ass show, and not a very good one, outside of the Hardy Boys' return, which got just an amazing reaction. But you know what? It's all worth it, because here we are at 12:15 in the morning. This was a 7-hour show, And everybody was just transfixed on this one moment because we thought we were witnessing the end of The Undertaker's career. I thought I was going to be able to look back on this and say, hey, I was there live for the final moment of The Undertaker's career. And that would have been the perfect send-off for him. Put somebody over. Wasn't a very good match at all. That kind of sucked. But in terms of him leaving everything in that ring and disappearing into a plume of smoke, that is one of the scenarios that a lot of people, I think, have thought about as far as how does The Undertaker end it? He doesn't end it with a speech. He just sort of vanishes. That would sort of make sense. And he admitted here, he said, at this point, I'm done. That's it. Going into this thing, I thought this was it. This was going to be the moment. He says, and even Austin said, dude, this would have been the perfect send-off for you. And he agrees. But he was talked into coming back. I have to assume by Vince McMahon. He says, I got talked into coming back, which was the John Cena match at WrestleMania 34. What a perfect send-off rendered meaningless just to get him to come back for a 3-minute match that was done 4 years too late. Without the streak still intact, there was absolutely no point to a match against John Cena. The drama was gone. The drama was gone. He talked about his injuries and how they've taken a toll on his body. For him now, it's about the challenge of getting ready to perform. Can he still do it? When he gets that call from Vince McMahon, hey, Taker, we need you for Saudi Arabia. We need you for WrestleMania. We need you for this or that. For him, he still has this loyalty to Vince McMahon because Vince McMahon's the one who gave him his big break. When he was told very early on in his career by the powers that be in the NWA or WCW, whatever it was, that, you know, you're never going to make money. I'm never going to be able to make money off you in this business. And you look back on how ridiculous that was now. It's like Eric Bischoff saying something similar about Austin in WCW. This guy's never going to get over. Never going to make money off this guy. Well, who's the fool now? So he still, after all these years, has that loyalty to Vince McMahon, where if Vince calls him and says, I need you, he'll do it. But it's a whole process now for him to get his body ready, because his body has just been ravaged by all of these matches and all of these injuries and the hip and the groin and the knees. And I mean, think about the surgeries and the injuries that this guy has had over the course of 30 years. And he's a big guy. I don't know if he's maybe shrunk a few inches. Yeah, you get older, you start to shrink. Or you have certain types of surgery, back surgeries. Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan has shrunk a few inches from what he used to be. Guy's had 10 back surgeries. So it's only natural that that sort of thing happens. Undertaker is still a big dude. I mean, legit, he's probably every bit of 6'9", 6'10". You gotta think on a bigger guy like that. Especially on the knees and the lower body, it takes its toll. So, to him, it's a challenge. These are all favors done to Vince at this point. Every match that he has could be his last match. But these are all favors that he does for Vince McMahon. And he says, you know, there are times that he thinks to himself, damn, I stayed for too long. I never wanted to be that guy. He reiterated the same point he made in the Michael Landsberg interview in 2002. He does not, he's very cognizant, he says, of not wanting to be a parody of himself. He does not want to be the guy who stays too long. And there are times where he feels, damn, I stayed too long. But he did not say that he's done. It's very obvious that we have not seen his last match, but every match that he does have could be his last. There's no set number of matches that he has left. He does these as a favor to Vince McMahon. Only he can write his final chapter, he said. What that is, when it's going to be, he doesn't know. He didn't say. But obviously, he ain't done yet. He's not done yet. But he wants to write his own final chapter, and he does not appreciate other people. Unless it's like another legend that he respects, like a Steve Austin or a Triple H. He does not appreciate other people telling him what he should or should not do in terms of when he should hang up the boots. And I get that. And I get that. But you know what? As fans, you and I, we can voice our opinion. Because if you're a fan of his work, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, man, it's really sad sometimes to watch The Undertaker out there. He should have retired after WrestleMania 30, or he should have retired after WrestleMania 28, or WrestleMania 33. I wish he would just hang it up. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with voicing your opinion and saying, look, I just got done talking about The Irishman earlier, and De Niro, and Pacino, and you know, you watch them sometimes, and it's sad. And you kind of think to yourself, man, a movie like this would be a great way for them to go out, but is this the last movie that they're going to film? I mean, Pesci, maybe. But the others, of course not. They're going to get a payday, and Pacino's going to keep making movies until he drops. And De Niro's going to keep making movies until he drops. And that's their prerogative. That's their choice. They have, you know, that's their job. They have a living they have to make. It's no different with pro wrestlers. If you're a fan of their work, you want to remember them as they were. You don't want to remember that, like when Bret Hart came back at WrestleMania 26, and there were certain insurance restrictions as far as not taking any shots to the head. Here's a guy who had a stroke, who largely recovered from the stroke, but you could still tell it still has lingering effects from it. Major concussion, then had a stroke. It's a lot older now, and you watch him in the ring, and it was more sad than anything else. That's not the way I want to remember Bret Hart. And I'm the biggest Bret Hart fan you'll find. But as a fan, you have moments like that where you watch and you feel, not that you feel, it's the word I'm looking for. You don't feel sorry for them. You feel sad. Because you would love for there to be this storybook ending where they go out on that high note. Most people don't go out on a high note. That's more of like a general statement. Even in television, how many TV shows go past their expiration date? Now there's rumors that The Simpsons, after 2021 or whatever the last contract ends, that's going to be it. The composer of the theme, Danny Elfman, the composer of the theme song for the Simpsons, said he heard possibly that the show is finally going to come to an end in a couple of years. We've been hearing rumors about that for probably over a decade now. There's a lot of people, and I haven't watched The Simpsons, and I don't even know how many years. I'm not like a huge Simpsons fan, but there are a lot of Simpsons fans out there who probably would be of the opinion that this show should have been over a hell of a long time ago. But it keeps going. It keeps going on and on and on and on. Jerry Seinfeld maybe is one of the few people who you could say possibly went out on a high note. Didn't try not to overstay his welcome with his TV show. It's just the way it is. When you have a good thing going, you don't want to see it end. It's very hard to just say, you know what? I think I'm done. Jack Briscoe, all those years ago, one of the biggest wrestlers in the world. He just had this moment where he said, I'm done. He could have wrestled for years and years and years after that. He recognized when it was his time. He said, I'm done. And very few people, I think, have it in them to know when it's time to go and to actually pull the trigger and say, that's it, I'm done. So Undertaker is far from done, but he claims that he's cognizant. He doesn't want to become that guy. You can argue whether or not he's already there, but he claims that he's very sensitive to that, and he does not want to be that guy. Now, he talked about the end of the streak and the match with Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 30, another example of not wanting to go out like that. The Goldberg match in Saudi Arabia. He did not want that to be the last image that people had of him in the ring, which is why he came back, I think, the following month, and he did that tag team match with Roman Reigns, and he looked a hell of a lot better in that match. And I believe that was the last time we saw him in the ring. It was back in July. So with the Brock Lesnar match, I thought that match was no good. And being there live in the building, a lot of people agreed with me. People were not into that match. It was not a good match at all. It became this iconic match because of the final 10 seconds. But Undertaker, as he talked about here, he was concussed in the first few minutes of the match. Now, he doesn't know where it happened. It's not Brock's fault. He does not blame Brock Lesnar. It was probably on some kind of a suplex of sorts. He just landed the wrong way. He landed on his head a certain way. And he got his bell rung, and he got messed up real bad. Now, there is a suplex that he took in the ring. It may have been a belly-to-belly near the beginning where he does kind of land on his head. It could have been that, but who knows? He doesn't know when it happened, but he was on autopilot for the rest of the match after that. And the scary part is that he has no memory of the match at all whatsoever. Like Daniel Bryan. Remember that one episode of Raw, one of the greatest segments in Monday Night Raw history. And Daniel Bryan has no recollection of it whatsoever. Was the night that he finally broke away from the Wyatt family. He was in the cage. There was some kind of cage match. I think they lost, he and Bray. Maybe like a tag match. And it was just him and Bray left inside the cage. This was probably in the build-up to their singles match, I'm guessing, at the Royal Rumble in 2014. And Bryan finally breaks free from the grip of the Wyatt family, and the fans had been waiting for this for weeks. It all built to this moment, and Bryan just starts throwing drop kicks at Bray. He's doing the yes kicks. These people are losing their minds. And it was the first time I can remember him doing the thing where he goes into the corner and he's throwing up the fingers to do the yes thing very slowly to get the fans into it. Now, he had done this before. I think he had done it actually in the match with Cena at SummerSlam a few months earlier. But this was the first time I can remember where they got this wide shot of the audience. And it was this slow zoom in, but you see everybody in the building. Like, it was this amazing just crowd shot that I'll never forget. And then he does the running knee, and he climbs to the top of the cage, and he's sitting on top of this cage 12 feet up doing the yes thing, and they go off the air. It's a great moment. He got concussed. He got his bell rung in there somewhere and has no memory of it at all. Or at least that was the story at the time. No memory of it. Imagine having a moment like that and not even, like, you're watching it back and you don't even remember what happened. You don't remember being there. Concussions are scary shit. And that was the experience that The Undertaker had at WrestleMania that year. He remembers nothing after a conversation he had with his wife at 3:30 in the afternoon. His memory picks up at 5:30 the next morning when he's in the hospital and he doesn't know his name. He doesn't know his birthday. He doesn't know where he is. Because he went by ambulance right from WrestleMania straight to the hospital once he came back through the curtain. He basically collapsed when he got to the back. There's a WrestleMania documentary. They don't show you him falling down and collapsing. But there's this one moment in the gorilla position. You can hear people saying something about Undertaker. Undertaker's down and people are scurrying around. It's a really scary moment. And I remember reading that, you know, Vince McMahon, he left the show to go with the Undertaker in the ambulance to the hospital. Now, he never mentioned that here, probably because he doesn't remember. He probably has no memory of it. But yeah, Vince McMahon was not there. He was not present live in the building for the big finale of Daniel Bryan winning the world title that year at WrestleMania because he had gone with The Undertaker off to the hospital. So that's what happens when you have a really bad concussion. There's some lighthearted stuff towards the end. They tell some really funny stories Taker and Austin do about working together back in the late 90s at some of the Kuwait shows overseas in the Middle East and some fun shenanigans there. They have this reel of segments, footage that they show, post-show stuff over the years of guys trying to break The Undertaker and get him to laugh. They showed something with JBL. They showed the attempt to get Undertaker to do the Spinner-Rooney, the Taker-Rooney, which he got out of somehow. He managed to avoid having to do the Spinner-Rooney. He was not very, he was not thrilled about that. Even Vince McMahon came out. He did his own Vince-a-Rooney and said, look, if I can do it, you can do it. Nope, still wouldn't do it. Somewhere in here, he snuck away, and he never did do it. But I thought that this was just a tremendous piece of business here. It's absolutely worth going out of your way. Take 90 minutes out of your day to go see it. They barely scratched the surface of things to talk about here. And as good as his memory seems to be, I want to hear about being backstage in Montreal. Banging on the door to Vince McMahon's office, trying to get him to come out and do the right thing and go apologize to Brett for what you did. That was always the story with him. He didn't have a match on that show, but supposedly Undertaker was in the back and he was hot that night after the screw job happened, We've heard so many screwjob stories from Vince McMahon's perspective and Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart. I want to hear Undertaker talk about it. For a change. What was his perspective on it? What was he doing that night? The story about taping up his fists when it looked like Shawn Michaels might not be willing to do the job for Stone Cold at WrestleMania 14. He kind of touched on that in the Landsberg interview. I want to hear him talk more about that. Well, the wrestler's court stuff that I find so fascinating. Let him talk about that. The Kane storyline. Deep dive into the WrestleMania 25 match with Shawn Michaels and landing on his head. On that botched dive outside the ring. What was going through his mind then? Other than the ground. What else was going through his head? I mean, to this day, Sting still talks about wanting to do a match with The Undertaker. Even though he will never be cleared by WWE doctors. He still has this glimmer of hope. That there could be some confrontation of some kind. One day with him and The Undertaker. He just will not let this go. They just had a Sting documentary on the network about the night that he got hurt against Seth Rollins. And again, at the very end, he brings it up. Him, Undertaker, hey, you never know. Some Saudi prince willing to pay enough money. The crown prince wants it, you never know. Why not ask Undertaker about Sting and the match that never was? And is it a case where he just didn't want to work with him? So I've always been very fuzzy on that. The Undertaker doesn't really... Not that he doesn't like Sting, but like he didn't really want to work with him when they could have done the match in 2011. That's why it didn't happen. I mean, there's so many different rumors about this. Get his perspective. What does he think about Sting? The only time he ever wrestled Sting was... I don't think he ever did. It was Kane who did. You know, when Kane was... playing some other character in WCW in the early 90s, he had a TV match against Sting. I don't know that Undertaker and Sting ever actually had a match of any kind at any time. Maybe when he was Mean Mark, they did. Maybe I'm just forgetting. But what about working with Sting? Is that something that he wanted to do and time ran out, or it just wasn't something he was really interested in? Again, these are the kinds of questions I would love to hear him talk about. And I hope we get to see the rest of that footage, and they have him back for more. This was worth the $9.99 for the network. I highly recommend that you check this out. Raw last Monday was live from the Allstate Arena in Rosemont, Illinois. But let's call it Chicago over and over and over again, like WWE does. Twitter poll had over 3,600 votes. We almost had ourselves a perfect 50-50 tie this week. But the thumbs-up crowd pulled ahead at the last minute. And the final results... And this might be the first time this has happened in 2 months. 51% thumbs up, 49% thumbs down. As close a margin as we have had for a Raw poll maybe in years. And probably the first thumbs up for Monday Night Raw going back to, I'm guessing, late September, probably. AEW may have gotten a full gear bump for their first episode of Dynamite after their pay-per-view. WWE, they didn't get a post-Survivor Series bump in the ratings. They were down to 2.1 million viewers opposite a very lopsided Monday Night Football game, so you can't really blame that. I believe November of this year was a record low month for Raw numbers as compared to a year ago, and that was a record low month at that time as well. So the bleeding continues year over year. You know, I see people blaming it on Seth Rollins. Oh, it's Seth Rollins' fault. What a terrible champion he was. And he's not a draw. And this and that. And like this week, oh, the ratings were down, of course, because Seth Rollins was featured. Well, it was also the Kevin Owens show. If you're going to lay the fall on one person, you can't blame Seth Rollins. You know who you can lay it on? Vince McMahon. It's his show. Now, speaking of Seth Rollins, we had that town hall segment at the beginning of the show. The entire Raw roster was surrounding the ring, and Rollins was giving... And who knows, maybe this was a play off the Meltzer story from a few weeks ago. Because here's Seth Rollins, right? Supposed to be giving a rah-rah speech to the Raw roster, and instead... Or would it be called a rah-rah speech? That's terrible, I apologize. But he's in the ring, and he's giving this speech, and instead he just berates everybody. He says, you all suck. Basically, it's what he said, you all suck. You dropped the ball at Survivor Series. You're all to blame. We've now gone from being the A show to being the C show, which is true. And he throws it to anybody who wants to speak up and says, anybody has something to say, grab a mic and speak now. Basically, speak now or forever hold your peace. And he insults Randy Orton. He says, you were the weak link on the Raw team at Survivor Series. So Orton walks off. He does the, basically the, what do you call it? The hand motion to suck his you-know-what, because that's what Randy Orton does. He does what he wants. And so he walks off. And Charlotte is the next target that Rollins sets his sights on and says, you know, you were supposed to lead our women to victory at Survivor Series, and that didn't happen. And, you know, you call yourself a flare. And so Charlotte walks off, and soon everybody walks. He insults AOP, Authors of Pain. Important to remember that for what would happen later on in the show. They walk off. The entire roster basically leaves, except for Kevin Owens. He stays behind. The two of them go back and forth on the microphone, and Owens ends up laying him out with a stunner. And this leads to a match later in the show between Seth Rollins and Kevin Owens. Now, there was a comment that Rollins made at the beginning of this. The crowd started chanting CM Punk. They were in Chicago. And so he kind of went off script a little bit, and he said, you know, look, I tried to get the guy here, but he didn't want to come. He didn't want to show up. He wants to sit behind his desk in Los Angeles and talk about a change that he's too afraid to make himself. And by him doing that, he's going to make people think that he is basically shooting an angle here to build to a match at WrestleMania between himself and CM Punk. That is what most wrestling fans watching this would probably be led to believe. And because of that, Vince McMahon was said to have been furious with Seth Rollins, even, he didn't mention him by name, but even talking at all in any way about CM Punk. Because he does not want to give people false hope for a match that is not going to happen. And it's not going to happen. This is not some kind of work or angle to build to a match at WrestleMania 36. I think Punk's going to be back, but not until WrestleMania 37. Or 38, I really don't think he's coming back anytime soon. So all of this stuff that's going on, I don't think it's some kind of elaborate setup for a match at WrestleMania between Punk and Rollins. And Vince McMahon is looking at this probably and saying, what the fuck are you doing? I don't want people to think that there's going to be a match between you guys. Now, I don't have a problem with Rollins doing what he did here. I like that. I think more people should react to the crowd. You know, don't be afraid. I commend him for doing it, but I can also understand Vince being really frustrated. It's like when Austin cut a promo on his show when he was doing the old podcast show on the network, and he was basically, who's he cutting a promo? It was Brock. He's cutting a promo on Brock Lesnar. And Vince McMahon was said to be furious because he's building a match that they have no intention of promoting. And you're giving people this false hope, and then when they don't deliver, all of a sudden it's the company's fault, and it's Vince McMahon's fault for promoting a match that was never going to happen in the first place. So I kind of see both sides of it, but I like it when people go off script and react to the crowd. You can't be robots. You've got to be able to kind of roll with the punches, and that's all Rollins was doing here. I'll defend him on that. I don't see anything wrong with that. In that instance, I thought it was fine. Rollins now being positioned as the bad guy, it was the only way to go. Embracing heel Seth Rollins was the only way to go. They had no choice in this matter. He was dying a death on TV with these crowds. And they don't look at him the same as they do Roman Reigns, because they resisted ever turning Roman Reigns. Think of how much people hated this guy and the booing and the reactions that he would get. It was the Cena treatment that he started getting. And how many times did people say, you gotta turn him heel? It'll pay off in the end. Some of the best baby faces, they're heels first, or they turn heel, and they do that for a while, maybe even a few years. And then when it's time to turn them back, man, poof, if you do it the right way, they're going to be even more over than they were in the first place. And I thought that was the way to go years ago with Roman Reigns, and Vince McMahon would not do it. He was the chosen one. We're not going to turn him heel. And they resisted and resisted and resisted because he was their crown jewel. But the first sign of trouble here with Seth Rollins, a few months later, here we are, and they're turning him heel. So you can tell who the real top guy is just based on that alone. They're doing with Rollins something they never would have done with Roman Reigns. But I think it was absolutely the right thing to do. Now, he didn't turn full-on heel. He certainly acted that way on TV on Monday night, and he was teasing it. He didn't go full heel, not yet. Looks like they're going to build to it slowly. Unless he just comes out on TV tomorrow night, and they complete the turn tomorrow night. But this had to be done. To save Seth Rollins, this is what had to be done. And it was another week, by the way, and another DQ finish to a Seth Rollins match on Monday Night Raw. I believe that might be about four straight weeks of them here on this TV show, which is kind of ridiculous. He wrestled Kevin Owens in the main event. It did go to a DQ finish. Authors of Pain came out, beat up Kevin Owens, did not go after Seth Rollins. But they also didn't embrace him. But it sure seemed to me like they're building to AOP being the henchman for Seth Rollins, almost like a new Shield 2.0, like new Coke, new flavor. Not as good as the original, but they're going to try. I think that's the way to go. I hope that that's exactly what ends up happening, and they're not just swerving us on this. I think that Rollins leading some kind of small group and having these guys do his dirty work. So, like, Rollins can talk shit about anybody he wants to, but he hides behind these two. That's a great way to get heel heat. So that's where I think it's going. That's where they want you to think it's going. We'll see how it plays out on TV this week. Was kind of weird. AOP were two guys that Rollins targeted on his diatribe at the beginning of the show. I think that was just to throw us off the scent. It's not like, well, it makes no sense. Well, it makes perfect sense. If he just wanted you to not think that he had anything to do with those two guys, throw you off the scent, yeah, he would go after them verbally. They didn't beat him up. They didn't put their hands on him. They could have. So it seems to me that's where this is going. I think it's the right way to go. Buddy Murphy, he pinned the returning Matt Hardy. We haven't seen Matt Hardy on TV in many months. I thought he looked good. He looked a little slimmer than the last time we saw him. He was just Matt Hardy. He was not Woken Matt, Broken Matt, or any other incarnation of Matt Hardy other than just Matt Hardy. And he lost very quickly, very decisively, to Buddy Murphy. So, how did this all come about? Is Matt Hardy back for good? Do they have some kind of plan for him? Apparently the answer is no. His wife, Rebby, is about to give birth to their third child, I guess. She's going to go into labor, it seems like, any day now. And all of a sudden, Matt Hardy, after being off TV for months, gets called at the last minute to fly to Chicago to do what ended up really being this meaningless nothing match with Buddy Murphy, where he just gets kneed in the face and then pinned and beaten in about 3 minutes. And his wife was not happy about this. She was posting on Twitter, and she said, WWE had seen... She had posted a tweet basically saying she thought she was going into labor a couple days earlier. It was a false alarm. But then, the stuff happened with Matt, and Rebby is a very outspoken personality. And she had posted this tweet saying, WWE saw this tweet and was like, okay, guys, right now is the time to send Matt back to work. So she was not happy at all that he got called to work, let alone for that. The PW Insider, they confirmed that Matt Hardy's contract is expiring in February of next year. So he's only got a few months left on his contract. They are in discussions. It's not a money issue. The issue that they have run into is, what are they going to do with Matt Hardy? How are they going to use him? What are they going to do with him? What kind of push is he going to get? What kind of ideas do they have for his character? Because you have to think, it probably does not involve his brother Jeff. Jeff is a wild card at this point. We don't know when or even if he'll be back. He's got bigger problems right now, and I totally get it. Matt Hardy, he's got to look out for himself. He can't be tied down to his brother like some kind of anchor that's going to just drag him down. He's got to be able to do his own thing. So what do you got for me? Matt's getting older. Matt Hardy is not a priority in WWE. He's not a guy that they're going to be looking to give some kind of big push to. The time to do it was when he first, after the Hardys came back, and I think Matt went on some kind of losing streak, and then they finally were embracing the Woken, they called it Woken gimmick. If you were going to do the broken stuff, you go full throttle with it. And they never did. They never really went all in on that. That was the time to give him a big singles push. And look, maybe it flops. It was a big hit in Impact, but Impact is a small... He was a big fish in a small pond compared to WWE, which has this... I mean, talk about a gigantic roster. They've got more bodies under contract now than at any point in their history. Are they really going to give Matt Hardy this full, big blowout push with the character? No, they never did. And that was the time to do it. So what are they going to do now in 2020? Matt Hardy wants to know, what are you guys going to do with me? You're going to have me come to TV every few weeks just to put somebody over and that's it? Am I just going to be that guy on the roster? So yeah, I make a lot of money. You know, my family's future is secure. The money is great, but I'm not being creatively fulfilled. Matt Hardy, he's a very creative guy. He came up with the Broken Universe all by himself. He cultivated that whole thing. That was all his idea. So I can understand a guy like him. He's not just in it for the money. He wants to know, what the fuck are you going to do with me? You're going to make me sign, what, a 5-year contract? How old is Matt? I don't have his age in front of me. Is he 40? If he's not 40 yet, he's closing in on 40. He signs a 5-year contract with this company. That's it. That's probably the last big contract he will ever sign with any promotion. So it makes sense that he wants to know, what are you going to do with me? I need to have a sense before I sign any kind of contract that you put in front of me. And that's the sticking point right now. So he may well walk. He may let his contract run out and he may walk. I don't know if he'd go back to Impact. I don't know if he'd end up in AEW. I don't know if he would just do indies, if he would go back to the broken stuff, come up with something completely new. So that'll be a story to watch, you know, in the next few months going forward. Jeff's not going anywhere. I'm not sure Jeff should be wrestling. But he's missed so much time now, because remember, he was off for an injury that he was healing from, like a knee injury, I think he was healing from. They're not going to let Jeff Hardy go. Of the two Hardy brothers, who's the one that WWE always prioritized? It was Jeff. Jeff was the bigger single star. Jeff was the one they were kind of building around for a little while there. Jeff's probably the one they see real value in. Even with all of his demons and all of his problems, you think they're just going to let him go? So let's say his contract is up at the same time in February of 2020. You think they're just going to let his contract lapse and let him go? After how many arrests now? They haven't let him go previously. They haven't fired him. They're going to let him go all of a sudden? Of course not. They're going to keep him under contract as long as they possibly can. So Matt's got to think for himself and say, listen, you know, give me a sense of what you're going to do with me. Otherwise, I'm out of here. I don't need your money. Money's great. I don't need it. I can go make money just doing the old broken stuff, probably on the independent scene, and I can be very comfortable with my life. So they had the United States Championship, was supposed to be defended. Humberto Carrillo was going to challenge AJ Styles. Carrillo got beat up by the Good Brothers before the match even started, so he was taken out. And AJ thought he was going to get the night off. So then they had the parade of guys who come out. They've done these segments before. It's always stupid. Rey Mysterio came out. Drew McIntyre came out. Randy Orton came out. Ricochet came out. So the end result of all this was a fatal four-way, with the winner challenging AJ Styles for the championship later on in the show. Rey Mysterio wins the fatal four-way. Now, he's coming off a loss to Brock Lesnar at Survivor Series. Him and Dominic, they tried to get the job done. They failed. So now Rey wins this match, and he's going to challenge AJ for the U.S. title. They go right into it. So they do the match. And I like the way that they built this up. The fans were all into it. Rey's big win here came off great. Rey Mysterio is the new United States champion. He does pick up the win. There was a ref bump. Good Brothers tried to attack and beat Rey down. Randy Orton came out. There was a magic killer attempt. Orton came down to stop it. And he ended up giving an RKO, I think, to AJ Styles. And then the 619, the big frog splash. The way they did this was great. And even on Twitter after, Orton was basically saying to Rey, you're welcome. And Rey said, look, I owe a debt of gratitude to Randy Orton. He helped me win. So at least he acknowledges it. Rey Mysterio is the new champion. Randy Orton now is, I don't know if he'll be getting the next shot or if they're going to do something with Orton and AJ after what happened. But the way this all played out and the matches themselves were some of the highlights of the show, I thought, on Monday night. I just thought this was really well done. Dominic came out. He was celebrating with his father. He put his father up on his shoulders. I wasn't sure for a second who was the son and who was the dad with Ray on his son's shoulders like that. But this was really well done. And Asuka and Charlotte had a singles match that went a very long time that I thought was pretty good too. And Asuka got the win. Green mist again to the face. Asuka picks up the win. I can get behind that. I won't ever complain about an Asuka win. But an Asuka win here over Charlotte sounds good to me. And then we had the Kevin Owens Seth Rollins match, which I mentioned earlier went to a DQ, and they sure do want you to think that there might be some kind of alliance of some kind between Rollins and AOP, which I think would be the way to go. So there were definite highlights of the show on Monday night. They still have a long way to go. It's hard for them, if not damn near impossible, to put together a 3-hour long show that is fully engaging. But there was enough on that show where if they can just build on that, there's some hope that we might have more of these 51-49 wins in the Twitter poll for Raw. Maybe next week, maybe tomorrow night. Maybe they'll do 52-48. Yeah, you might say, well, it's basically a tie. I mean, it wasn't like an overwhelmingly positive response. But yeah, 51-49 is still a huge improvement over 20% up, 80% down. So it's something that they can at least build on. Tomorrow will tell the tale as far as where they're going as we head into TLC. And tomorrow night, they're advertising a Seth Rollins public apology to the Raw roster, which is either going to be really, really bad, or if he ends up just completely excoriating them and going full heel, it could be somewhat entertaining. And they're building a handicap match with the Kabuki Warriors against Charlotte Flair, 2-on-1. Not a very inspiring lineup for tomorrow night, but I am going to withhold judgment until I see the show. SmackDown on Fox. I said the other day I watched the Irishman instead of SmackDown. Figured I'd catch up with SmackDown later on. I have had a very busy weekend. I almost even forgot that SmackDown was on. It just was not a priority for me. It's a holiday weekend. It's not a priority at all. I skimmed parts of the show. I really just wanted to watch The Fiend stuff and see what was going down with Daniel Bryan and The Fiend. When I saw that there was, I started watching the back and forth with Corbin and Roman Reigns. That was it. I was done. I was done with SmackDown. So I'm not even going to get into anything that happened on this show outside of The Fiend because I don't care. I don't care. Now, we did get a Sheamus vignette. I saw this actually on the YouTube channel. Sheamus is on his way back to SmackDown, which is cool. I'm not, a big Sheamus mark or anything like that, but the guy's been out ever since he got a bad concussion. I just talked about concussions earlier with The Undertaker. Bad concussion he suffered. I think it was the SmackDown after WrestleMania this year. And that was the end of the bar with him and Cesaro. And we have not seen him since. Not on TV. He's been doing his Celtic Warrior workout videos on YouTube, which are very entertaining. He's been keeping busy in that respect. But this was the first appearance on television for Sheamus in many, many months. He's coming to SmackDown. So good for him. I'm glad he's feeling better and he's cleared and he's ready to come back. And it'd be nice to see them try something different and not just put him and Cesaro back together. Maybe he and Cesaro can feud. Right? I mean, was the last time we saw he and Cesaro feud was probably a few years ago, right? Isn't that what happened? And then it led to them becoming a tag team. I think that's what happened. Maybe they'll feud. Who knows? Seems like he's coming back as a heel, but we don't know yet. Alexa Bliss made her come back on this show as well. She came out to rescue Nikki Cross during a segment after a match that Nikki had rescued her from an onslaught by Mandy and Sonya. And then Bray Wyatt was going to introduce a new character in the Firefly Funhouse. And I'm thinking, well, maybe it'll be a female character. I saw Liv Morgan's name floating around online. I just talked about her a few weeks ago, right? Where is Liv Morgan? Why are they not following up on that story from TV a few months ago where she was going to come back with this totally new character and then we never saw her again. Well, it had nothing to do with that. The new character, I guess, that he was introducing to the Funhouse is the Fiend now has his own custom championship. So the Universal Blueberry Belt, I guess, will be for Mr. Rogers Wyatt when we see him. But when we see the Fiend, when the Fiend comes out for a match, he now has his own custom title, the way that Stone Cold had the Smoking Skull Belt and the Million Dollar Man had the Million Dollar Belt. The Rock had a Brahma Bull Belt, even though we never saw it on TV, but they did make one. Now Bray Wyatt, the Fiend, has a Fiend Championship. And at the end of the show, he came up through a hole in the ring and with the Blade and the Butcher and the Bunny. No, I'm kidding. Came up through a hole in the ring and put the mandible claw on Daniel Bryan, dragged him down underneath the ring. And then when Bray, so he's standing in this hole and he's reaching down under the ring and they want you to think that he's ripping the hair from Daniel Bryan's head, maybe his face, maybe he's ripping his beard off. So now everyone's wondering, what's Daniel Bryan going to look like the next time we see him on TV? Is he going to shave his head? Is he going to shave his face? Is he going to be totally bald? Is it going to be like Kane when Kane was unmasked in 2003 and he had little patches of missing hair in his head? What's he going to look like? You know, is it going to be the old American Dragon look from 10 years ago? I hope not. You know why? Because I'm going to start getting all these comments again. Hey, what's Solomonster doing on SmackDown? How could he be on SmackDown and on AEW Dynamite at the same time? Because apparently I look like every white guy in the world. He was the first guy that I was compared to years ago. I would go to the Ring of Honor shows and the guys, it was always the same guys at the door. They would look at me, they would rip my ticket or whatever, and they would kind of laugh. Oh, look, it's Baby Dragon. And I would go in, and this was during the American Dragon phase, you know, Bryan Danielson having all these kick-ass matches in Ring of Honor. And that was the first time people started saying, hey, you know who you look like? I go, yes, I know. I don't need you to tell me. This is before he had the beard and the facial hair and all that, which I've never had. So if he does go back to that old look, oh boy, here we go again. But anyway, so we'll see what his look is come Friday night on SmackDown. The new belt. What do I think about the new belt? I have two views on this. On the one hand, I like the fact that they gave him a custom championship like this instead of just changing the color of the existing Universal belt. Or giving him side plates like they do for everybody else. I do think a character like this needs to have his own unique spin on things. So I like the fact that they gave him his own custom belt. What that does not mean, though, is that I have to like the way that the belt looks. Like the Smoking Skull title with the snakeskin backing, that was cool. That was cool. You could still buy those replicas even today. They must be selling well because they still sell them. This thing does not really come off to me as something that is overly exciting to look at. It's a little creepy. I guess that's the look they're going for, right? So in a way, it fits the Fiend character, but it is an ugly looking belt. It's the sort of thing where I'm not exactly sure why anybody would want to fight for it. I guess the idea is that whoever's going to beat the Fiend at some point, we'll be able to kind of ditch the belt and get the old one back. But it's not the sort of thing where if you're wrestling this guy for a championship and that's the championship, that you really want to put maximum effort in to try to win that championship, because it's ugly as sin. You can buy one of these Fiend replica masks for $30 that they sell on WWE Shop and just tape it. You could literally take two belts that you use to hold up your pants and then staple or tape a Fiend mask to the center of it, and you will have your own replica of the new Fiend title. But WWE, they're always one step ahead. You don't have to go ahead and do that. You can buy an actual replica of the Fiend custom Universal Championship right now. It is the Fiend custom handcrafted title on WWE Shop. They have it available for what they're calling a limited run. It is a limited run pre-order item that will begin to ship on December 20th. So you may not get it in time for Christmas. Be aware. be forewarned. Although I don't think anybody listening to this right now is going to even be buying this thing, and I'll tell you why in a second. But you look at the product specs and all the details, handcrafted by Tom Savini Studios. Tom Savini himself is not working on this shit, but Tom Savini Studios is going to handcraft this title, and the mask on the belt is made of a latex skin and acrylic eyes that capture the intense stare of the Fiend, Bray Wyatt, 64 inches long, the height, 12 inches, 7 pounds, 8 ounces. They're all individually numbered, certified authentic. Each title comes with, it's going to be numbered. Certificate of authenticity, hand signed by Tom Savini himself. Genuine leather strap. So those are the specs on this thing. You would think, man, this thing's going to be pretty pricey. I mean, you see some of these custom deluxe belts that they sell on WWE Shop, $500, $600. This thing could be pushing $1,000. $6,499.99. Plus $576 in taxes. The final total, if you want to buy this belt for yourself or for a friend, for a Fiend, $7,000 is what it will set you back. But at least you get free shipping. You do get free shipping on your order. $7,000. For $7,000, that fucking thing better be made of actual human skin. And the Fiend needs to personally deliver that thing to my house and put on a Firefly Funhouse puppet show. I don't care if it's in a diorama shoebox. I need a personal puppet show from Bray Wyatt himself when he rings my doorbell to hand deliver this thing to me on my doorstep. You could buy an engagement ring for your girlfriend with that money. You could buy a car or put a payment towards a new car. Or if you really like belts, put this in perspective. If you are a championship belt mark, and I like championship belts too. I have two of them myself. I have one from when I was in college when they first started making these replicas. I thought it was so cool. Wow, they're actually making real replicas. I gotta buy one. So I bought the big gold belt from the Attitude Era. And then years later, I was gifted the classic Winged Eagle that I had relet, which was always my favorite title as a kid. I got it as a gift. Shout out to Matt, if he's listening. Had it re-leathered, it's on display, it's beautiful. Okay, so that's my little collection that I've got. Some people like buying championship belts, nothing wrong with that. But think about it like this. If you wanted the authentic Winged Eagle title, handmade by Reggie Parks himself, although I don't know if Reggie is actually doing these anymore, or if Dave Millican is now, but if you want an authentic, handcrafted Winged Eagle Championship, real leather strap, the thick plates, the whole nine yards, you know, like you would see on TV, the real deal, it would set you back $2,500. You could buy two of those and still have $2,000 left over. And you take a look at this thing, and I don't care if you think it looks cool or if you don't think it looks cool and you think it's the ugliest thing you've ever seen. $7,000 for this thing? That is, I mean, I don't even know what word to use to describe that. But I guess some people are going to look at it and say, well, it's a limited run item. If I buy this now and it's signed or something and it's got a certificate of authenticity and I hold on to it 5, 10, 15 years down the road, hey, maybe this thing will be worth twice as much. And if you have the money to spend on something like this, then God bless you. Maybe they look at it as an investment. Maybe they're just buying it because they figured they could turn it back around and sell it for more money. If you could do that, hey, by all means. $7,000 for the... You got to take a look at this thing. If you haven't seen it yet, I have it on... It's on the Facebook page, but $7,000 is easily the most expensive item ever in the history of WWE Shop. Clearly, it has to be. Well, what else would be? This thing ain't worth $7,000. And they know people aren't going to buy it. In mass, it's probably made to order. It's probably on demand. Order comes in, they handcraft it. I don't know how long it would take to make these things. I doubt they're going to make 100 of them and just keep them stockpiled in a warehouse somewhere. How many orders do you think they're going to get for this thing? Someone will buy it. I'm just wondering, how many of them are they going to sell? Do they even have to sell that many? $7,000 a pop? I mean, if they sell 10 of them, I mean, they've already made a nice little chunk of change. Now imagine if they get 50 people to buy this. Maybe in the end it'll be worth it for them. I think it's completely ridiculous. AEW on TNT this past week, the Thanksgiving Eve Dynamite show. The prevailing opinion seems to be that it was the weakest of all the shows so far. It definitely was not their best. I didn't dislike it as much as I know some of you did. I love the Jericho celebration segment at the beginning of the show. I thought Omega and Pac was very good. MJF winning the Dynamite Diamond Ring, predictable, but was the right move to make. And Jericho against Scorpio Sky in the main event was fine. The Butcher and the Blade stuff with Cody was outrageously stupid for Excalibur to know who they were and never explain how he knew who they were, seeing as how they've never once been on an AEW show before. And I mentioned Jim Ross's tweets from earlier where he basically said neither one of us were really supposed to acknowledge these people. And Excalibur kind of went and did that on his own. And I agree, it didn't really make a whole lot of sense. So even he knows it was stupid. It would at least make sense, though, if, and I said this on my Dynamite stream, you can make sense of these people showing up, even though what Excalibur did was idiotic. But you can make sense of this story-wise if this is the direction they go in. And I don't know if it is or not. But Allie, who they are now calling the Bunny for some inexplicable reason, perhaps we'll get the backstory on that as well, she got beat up by Awesome Kong and Brandi Rhodes a few weeks ago on TV, the last time we saw her on Dynamite. And now she had these two guys beat up Brandi's husband. So if that's the direction, at least in that respect, it kind of makes sense. But I have no idea if they're even going to acknowledge that or not. And also on the show, you had Jim Ross. While I agreed with him on all of that stuff, I'm with JR on that. You have Jim Ross calling Trent Beretta Taven, as in Matt Taven, who works for Ring of Honor and has never worked a single day for AEW. That is just inexcusable. I didn't even realize it happened until one of the callers during the live stream brought it up, and I damn near pissed myself laughing. Can you imagine Michael Cole accidentally calling Nakamura Ibushi on SmackDown? Like the uproar that would cause? There's just no excuse for that. Chris Statlander, I thought she was a standout on the show Wednesday night. I said they should either sign her or at least use her more often. According to The Observer, it looks like she may be signing with AEW. There's been interest from WWE as well. WWE apparently thought that they had her locked up and she was going to come in January. And now she's made a few appearances on AEW shows, and so the belief is that she may end up going there. But the choice is hers. You know, the interest is out there. Ball's in her court, wherever she chooses to go. I think she will be an asset to whatever women's division that she links up with. One more AEW note. A Facebook account claiming to be Chris Cruz, the former WCW announcer, posted that he had contacted the Maryland State Athletic Commission last week about the violence in the Kenny Omega-John Moxley Lights Out match at Full Gear, which took place in Baltimore. He inquired about their rules on blading and allowing matches to continue if someone is bleeding during a match, and he posted a whole chain of emails between himself and someone on behalf of the commission, which was present. They did have a presence, the commission did, at the pay-per-view. They had a doctor there. They now claim that there is an ongoing investigation of some kind. Although it's not clear to me that it's because of the emails they got from Chris Cruz or if there was an existing investigation that was already going on. That has not been made clear to me. It may well have been because of his emails. But Chris Cruz snitching on AEW, even though they may not have actually done anything wrong, I guess there's some kind of investigation going on. This guy, who has no connection or affiliation to the company at all, And from everything I've seen is just on Facebook, just insulting people and saying stupid shit all the time, which makes me wonder if this is even a legitimate account. I'm not 100% sure if that Facebook account is even his actual Facebook account. It just says Christopher Cruz. It has his picture. And everybody is just sort of assuming it's the real Chris Cruz. It may be. I've heard he's kind of a kooky guy. Maybe it is him. But I say this with, a little hint that perhaps it's not really him. I hope not, for his sake, because he doesn't come off looking very good. A lot of the things I've seen written on there. What is this guy's problem? I mean, look, I didn't like the match either. I wasn't a fan of the Omega-Moxley match. But I'm not about to call the State Athletic Commission to snitch about it. What a fucking weirdo that guy is. I mean, who does that? A fucking weirdo, that's who. I thought the post-Survivor Series NXT show was another very strong show. They were coming off this huge win for NXT at Survivor Series where they beat Raw, they beat SmackDown, and so they opened with this big roster celebration. Undisputed Era came out to cut a promo. Tommaso Ciampa's going back and forth on the microphone with Adam Cole. Finn Balor comes out. All the big guns are out there. I thought that was kind of a fun way to open the show. Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish defended the NXT Tag Team titles against Keith Lee and Dominik Dijakovic. Early in the match, there was a press slam out to the floor. Bobby Fish was dumped outside, and it rattled his brains enough that they took him out of the match during the next commercial break. He was gone, and in his place was Roderick Strong, very last minute, still wearing his street clothes, still wearing his long pants, out there to take Bobby Fish's place. He got his bell rung. As best as I could tell, he's okay now. It's not some kind of, I don't even know if he was actually concussed or not. It sounds like it was just a precautionary measure. But you could tell, looking at him, the way he was moving after that, he was not all there. And clearly the referee could see the same thing. So they got him out of there real quick. I thought this was a great match. There was a great near fall where Dijakovic gave O'Reilly a powerbomb and he gave Roderick Strong a chokeslam at the same time. So he chokeslammed him with one hand, and with the other hand, he did this sit-out or sit-down powerbomb. So that was cool. But then came one of the greatest things that I have ever seen. Adam Cole is marching down to the ring. Here he comes, right, for the interference. And he starts marching down to the ring when out of nowhere comes Keith Lee, who body checks Adam Cole over the barricade and into the crowd. Adam Cole disappeared off camera, possibly into another galaxy. The way that he flew through the air, it almost didn't look real. If I would have not have seen this for myself from like the USA feed, if somebody just uploaded a GIF or something, I would have said that this is obviously Photoshopped in some way. Nope, it's very real. It was just this incredible visual. They had a bunch of wrestlers planted in amongst the fans in the crowd, obviously, to kind of cushion his fall once he actually did land. It's not like Cole landed on top of Izzy or anything like that. Izzy doesn't even sit in that section anymore. She was one section over. She's still there. Izzy is still there at these shows, but she was one section over. So is Cole, probably. Now that I think about it, he was probably in another section too. Dijakovic was so mesmerized by all of this. He was completely distracted. He's watching. He's standing in the ring, and he is watching all of this unfold. And while this is going on, Strong and O'Reilly hit the high-low, and they pin him. Now, ordinarily, I would say, well, dumb babyface syndrome strikes again. He was just standing there. He looked like an idiot, which he kind of did, but I have to be fair about this. I would have been standing there looking like a fool too, after having just seen that. So I'll allow it. I'll allow it this one time. And yes, they beat Keith Lee coming off the biggest weekend of his career, but people aren't going to remember that. People are not going to remember the fact that Keith Lee was part of a tag team match where he lost but wasn't pinned. Dijakovic was pinned. Keith Lee did not get pinned. Keith Lee was not the victim of dumb babyface syndrome in this match. He was on the losing team. Nobody is going to remember this. What they're going to remember is him sending an American to the moon for the first time since 1972, and his name is Adam Cole. That's what they're going to remember. Mansoor picked up a win over Shane Thorne. Slingshot neckbreaker for the finish. We need to see him more than just twice a year at the Saudi shows. So it was good to see him here. He's really good. Mansoor is really good. And not just because, well, you know, of course he looked good in there with Cesaro on the last Saudi show. Cesaro's great. Yes, Cesaro is great. But give the guy credit. Mansoor is also very good. And I think he can be a big name on that NXT brand. And not just somebody because, you know, he's from Saudi descent. We have to just use him on those shows as, like, you know, our little token to the Saudi crown prince or the Saudi people, get a big reaction when he's on those shows. He can be on an NXT TakeOver show and could go in there and maybe steal the show with somebody. He has that potential, so hopefully we get to see more of him. This was a nice win for him here. Candice LeRae and Dakota Kai. Dakota Kai walked out holding up one of Tegan Nox's knee braces in her hand after that vicious heel turn and that vicious attack on her best friend at War Games, which was fantastic. She used the knee brace here to get herself disqualified. I like the harder edge that she has now. She's changed her look up and her hair and everything. She looks good. And she's got this mean streak about her now that was missing before. So I like it so far. I think I like where they're going with this. That was a very nasty bump that she took on the edge of the ring apron. Candice was going for a German, it looked like, but Dakota caught the very edge of the ring apron on her way down. Now, but if you thought that was crazy, the very next match is a Cruiserweight Championship match. Akira Tozawa challenging Lio Rush. And Tozawa is teasing doing the same exact thing to Lio Rush on the apron. Lio Rush blocks it. He delivers a kick to the back of Tozawa's head. And then a release German suplex off the apron to the floor. Actually, I kind of reversed that there. It wasn't Lio Rush hitting the kick. It was Tozawa who hit the kick to the back of the head. And then hit the suplex on Lio. A release German off the apron to the floor. Lio Rush rotated his body just in the nick of time. When you watch it on the replay, the landing doesn't look quite as devastating as it did at first. That's still a crazy move to take, though. And right after we had that scare in the match before, somebody's going to kill themselves on one of these moves one of these days. But you got everyone's just trying to top themselves. Always got to top the person before them, and at some point, you just get to that point where, I don't know, is it worth it? Is it worth the risk? I hope so. I hope it is. There was a great counter where Lio Rush came off the ropes for that move he uses now, the come up, which Mauro Ranallo named. I'm not going to die on that hill. I had my own name for it, whatever. It is what it is. My name for it was the bottoms up, but whatever. He calls it the come up. As he's coming up, though, off the bottom rope, he's bouncing off the bottom rope. Tozawa catches him in midair, turns it into a snap German. This was a really fun match. I enjoyed this. Rush won with the frog splash off the top. He's been putting together a very stellar list, has Lio Rush, of matches lately. Very impressive. Very low key. I feel like it's not really been getting a lot of attention. And they canceled 205 Live last week at the last minute. They were going to have 205 Live and they just canceled it. Now, maybe there was a logistical reason for it. Lio Rush, I know, as the Cruiserweight champion, was not very happy about that at all. And even tweeted something out about how, you know, the Cruiserweight division deserves more respect. You know, Lio can be a very outspoken guy. He was in the doghouse for a while after some comments that he had made. I didn't even know if he was going to be back. But he kept his job. And eventually they brought him back, and he's in a good spot right now. I think this is really the best spot for him to be in right now, and he keeps going out there and having matches like this, but he can be very outspoken. So you kind of, when you see a tweet like that, he didn't tweet, I don't think he tweeted anything wrong. I think actually there's a lot of truth in him saying that, and as the champion, he feels probably some responsibility to stand up for the other Cruiserweights and say, listen, we deserve more respect than this. Main event was Tommaso Ciampa and Finn Balor. I'm kind of surprised they gave this match away, to be honest with you. I thought they would at least build it up for next week or a couple weeks as an NXT television main event, but they had it here on this show. Adam Cole did come back out. I kind of didn't like that after what happened earlier with that big bump, that big spot with Keith Lee. He just comes right back out at the end of the show. That part I didn't really like. But anyway, his interference, Ciampa fought him off. Balor ended up picking up the win with the 1916, so Finn Balor wins. We have this pose-off, not pose-off, but Cole is in the ring, and he's posing, and Finn Balor is standing kind of in front of him in the ring, and Ciampa's down, and Cole starts patting him on the back, like, oh, good job, Finn. And Balor connects with the Pele kick to Cole, and so Balor's the last man standing. That's how they went off the air. Another strong episode, I think, of NXT, which is consistently, if it isn't the best show every week, it's certainly one of the top two shows every week. I think it is probably better than AEW on most weeks, which is not to say that AEW is a bad show. Quality-wise, NXT has been cranking out some of the best shows they've ever had, ever, in their history. And it was an easy win for NXT this week, because AEW was weaker than normal. But that isn't always reflected in the ratings. I don't even know what the ratings were this week, by the way. You'll notice I didn't mention them. I don't know if they were ever reported. I had looked around earlier to see if I missed something. I couldn't find them. So I have no idea what the ratings even were for the shows this week. But I had made the comment on Wednesday when I did the live stream. I said, it almost doesn't even matter. It almost does not even matter. It's a holiday show, Thanksgiving Eve. People are traveling. It's the heaviest travel day in this country all year. It almost does not even matter. You kind of throw it away and wait until this week. This Wednesday, I think, will tell the tale of where these two shows are right now. And did the NXT push work? That's what I'm curious about. NXT was put over very strongly on the main roster over the last 4 weeks. Going back to Adam Cole's win over Daniel Bryan on SmackDown on the very first day of November when they came back from Saudi Arabia. And every week we saw NXT people invading SmackDown, NXT people invading Monday Night Raw. They go to Survivor Series, and shockingly, refreshingly, NXT picks up the win. I think it was 4-2-1. Well, that's all over now. Everybody goes back to their own sandboxes. No more mixing of the brands. NXT goes back to Wednesday nights. Did they bring any of those eyeballs over with them? Them winning at Survivor Series. What did it really mean? Did they pick up new viewers? Did they win over new fans who didn't really know who these people were? They didn't know Rhea Ripley. They didn't know Matt Riddle. They didn't know Keith Lee. Now they do. Are they willing now to tune in on Wednesday nights and watch these people? That, I think, is going to be the story to look for. And that'll be reflected in the ratings coming up this week. But yeah, I couldn't even tell you what the numbers were for last week because I never saw them reported anywhere. NWA Power, Episode 8. This was a very polarizing episode. This was the first episode since the Jim Cornette controversy when he was removed, when he resigned from the NWA. And it was not well received. Last I checked, which was a couple days ago, so I have not checked this morning, but the last I checked, it had more thumbs, actually it had almost more thumbs down than thumbs up. Actually, you know what, let me check right now. I'm going to check right now here in real time. I must know if the thumbs down have overtaken the thumbs up in the YouTube ratings for this show, which would be amazing because this show has been very well received and well liked through most of its run so far. So for this to happen would be quite the 180 from what they normally do. All right, so they still have more thumbs up than thumbs down. 2,900 thumbs up, 2,500 thumbs down. But that ratio is not good. And you got to think it's a lot of backlash, clearly, for the Cornette move. Maybe a lot of Cornette fans are voicing their displeasure with the NWA doing what they did and moving on without him and scrubbing him from the shows and whatever it is they're going to do to remove his influence from these shows. They made their voices heard. During that live stream when the show debuted on Tuesday night, a lot of comments in the comments section playing off Into the Fire, which is the not just the name of their next pay-per-view, but that's the theme song by Dokken that opens every show. And there's a lot of comments playing off Into the Fire, saying, you know, Into the Fryer, Into the Dumpster. Obviously a lot of just very upset Jim Cornette fans. If you wanted wrestling, then you hated this show because there was one match on this show. There was no wrestling outside of an empty arena match pitting the question mark against one half of the Dawsons. But this was more of a highlight show to hype the pay-per-view coming up in 2 weeks. I don't know that this was a departure from what was originally planned to be the format for the show, because they had to scrub all the Cornette commentary. Is that why they did it this way? Or was this the plan all along? I don't have the definitive answer for you, but it is possible that this was going to happen no matter what, regardless of the Cornette stuff. I'm thinking that it was the plan anyway. And it was not well received. It was definitely the weakest of all the shows they've done so far. But here's the thing, here's why I didn't hate this show the way that other people seem to really have hated this show. Like, I can understand that if you just, I liked the wrestling and there were no other matches, there were no matches in studio, and so I hated it. All right, I can understand that. But this idea that the show was so radically different, where was the wrestling? How come we always get wrestling? Where was the wrestling? How many matches on this show in the previous 7 episodes have we seen that were really long, like great wrestling matches? We haven't had any. This is not a show that up to this point has been built around great wrestling matches. So was it really that much of a departure from, I mean, I understand they had Joe Galli in a studio and it wasn't in front of the live crowd. That was the biggest change in the format. But the idea, like even Monday Night Raw, we'll get the odd 15-20 minute match, some really good wrestling matches. We even had some this past week. We haven't gotten that on NWA Power. They've been building up to the pay-per-view for that. So when they have their Into the Fire show on December 14th, and we have the full card now, I'm going to run that down in a second, that's where you're going to get these longer, you know, better, more memorable matches. But the idea that, oh man, this was such a huge departure from the usual shows, we didn't get any wrestling. Well, how much wrestling do you get on a weekly basis? You have a minute match here, 90-second match there. It's like, what exactly are you referring to? So that was a little, I think some of the criticism was a little over the top in that you're not exactly getting great long wrestling matches every week up to this point. So I'm not really sure what was so, you know, what was missing this week that normally you would go gaga about outside of there not being a live crowd. And this is a show that is built heavy on personalities and interviews and promos in front of that live studio audience. So yes, that was the biggest departure. The wrestling. To complain about the lack of wrestling as compared to what you would normally get on one of these episodes, to me, is ridiculous. So the question mark pins Zane Dawson in a minute with the Mongrovian Spike in an empty arena match. As per the rules, the Dawsons then had to recite Shakespeare, which they go ahead and they do it. All the while, Aaron Stevens is vomiting into a garbage can while the question mark pats him on the back. I had many a night like that in my youth with my friends back in the day. In my youth. I talk like I'm 50 years old. But 10 years ago, when I was going out more often and having nights like that, there were plenty of times where I remember moments exactly like that. I remember having a friend throwing up on the sidewalk at 3:00 in the morning. And you're snapping at people as they walk by and they're staring. And you're like, I remember saying, like, what are you looking at? Keep walking. You act like you've never seen somebody throwing up before. That's also been me on many Monday nights over the past year during Raw. If you ever want to lose weight, I suggest the Monday Night Raw diet. I must have lost 10 pounds this year alone just from watching those shows. So we had that. There was this great Eli Drake promo that was taped from a Championship Wrestling from Hollywood show. Not great, but I thought it was very good. There's a great multi-part series they show throughout the show, showing Thunder Rosa, her preparation for her MMA fight, and then footage of her after the loss was over. Yeah, there were a lot of people saying, why is this on a wrestling show? This is MMA stuff, and she's supposed to be a heel. You're making me like her and turning her into a babyface. What are you doing? You know, I could see the whole heel babyface criticism, I guess, but I just thought this was really well done, and it was a deep dive into the person behind the character, and we got to know her a little bit better, and I'm all for that. I am all for character development and personality development on that level. And we don't know if Thunder Rose is going to be a heel going forward. Maybe they're priming the pump for a babyface turn. We don't know. I thought it was very well done. So Joe Galli did a sit-down interview with Melina. Melina is back. Melina is in the NWA. And he does a sit-down interview with her in studio, an empty studio. And Galli says, you know, your work in the ring helped revolutionize women's wrestling. And he asks her if she thinks that her role played a pivotal part in women's wrestling today. And she says, yes. And she made the comment, she said, before I came along, you didn't really see people care about their entrances. What? What are you talking about? I don't think Melina has seen as much wrestling as she says that she has in her time away from the ring. Hopefully that was just part of her heel shtick. She didn't. She did go on to call herself a living legend, and she was really talking herself up. Like, you would think this was all being done from the perspective of her being a heel. But my jaw dropped when she made that comment about, you know, before me, and I was doing the whole the splits during the entrance with Eminem. I assume that's what she was referring to. Before I came along, you didn't really have people focusing on their ring entrances. I was like, excuse me? What? So then she talked about she doesn't like the way Allison Kay treats people. She's not a good champion. And, you know, on the whole, I thought that she was good here. But that one comment just blew me away when I heard that. I certainly hope that that was not something she ad-libbed that she actually believes. So here's the lineup for the Into the Fire pay-per-view. This whole show on Tuesday last week built to the announcement of who Nick Aldis would be defending the 10 pounds of gold against at the pay-per-view. And so here's the full card. It does have a start time, so you know, on December 14th, that's a Saturday. Start time of 6.05 p.m. Eastern. You can purchase the show on Fight TV. Trevor Murdoch takes on the question mark. Ken Anderson battles Eli Drake. Colt Cabana will defend the national title. I think we'll find out this week who it'll be against. Allison Kay and Ashley Vox take on some combination of Melina, Thunder Rosa, and Marty Bell. And Nick Aldis will defend the 10 pounds of gold in the main event, I believe it's a 2 out of 3 falls match, against James Storm. And so that is your main event for Into the Fire. This Tuesday, Colt Cabana meets Ricky Starks. Non-title match, and the Rock and Roll Express will challenge the Wild Cards, Isaacs and Latimer, for the NWA World Tag Team titles. Ricky and Robert are going for their 9th NWA Tag Team title. That will be the main event on Tuesday, and that will be the first sign of whether or not they are scrubbing Jim Cornette's commentary from the show, or are they going to leave it in? You know, they don't have very many shows left before the pay-per-view. I don't see any reason why they can't just leave Cornette's commentary in. You'll have the usual people who will flip out. And look, I was one of those people who said Cornette had to go. When you have to apologize 2 different times for one of your employees' conduct, it's time for that person to leave. But I would have no issue with them leaving the commentary in. I mean, I don't even know how practical that is. You know, the guy's already gone. Just play out the string. Just leave his commentary in there. I don't have any issue with that, and I think the people who do need to get over themselves. But we'll find out. If we don't hear his voice, if he's muted, then we'll know that they took him out of the show. But he was there, you know, calling the action at the tapings, I'm sure, when the Rock and Roll Express had this match. And so we'll see if they pick up their 9th tag team titles on Tuesday. It's time for another edition of RSPW Rewind. We just saw The Undertaker sit down on the WWE Network with Stone Cold Steve Austin for an interview about his career. So, I thought it would be appropriate to start with a couple of threads about who else? The Undertaker. This first one is from Ryan Grant on April 6th, 1999. A post titled, "This is the worst thing ever on Raw," which was a quote, wasn't a statement so much as it was a quote taken directly from Jerry the King Lawler on Monday Night Raw during one of the angles that they did. I don't know exactly what the context was, but Ryan is no fan of the Ministry of Darkness. He says, "You said it, King. I've seen a shitload of lame from WWF over the years. I held my nose and smiled during the imposters angle. I actually kind of liked T.L. Hopper and the Goon. I was pissed off when they screwed Brett, but at least that sort of tangentially involved wrestling. The Ministry of Darkness, though, is a big heaping fresh steaming pile of horse shit. Bobo Guerrero can sleep easy now because the gobbledygooker is no longer the low point in WWF history. McMahon screaming, 'You evil bastard,' into the camera was not moving, touching, interesting, or anything else that would justify it being on my TV screen. It was funny, in the lamest, most pitiful sense of the word. When the Ministry wasn't the alpha and the omega of the WWF, I could shrug them off, because it was just a minor little angle. Now that they're the whole effing show, I give up. It's an indefensible angle. Will it sell more WWF stuff to the goth community? The way Bogus Prophet suggested? Probably. But for the love of Christ, is appealing to that market really worth it? Will angry Amish Undertaker really bring that many more fans and that much more money into the WWF? I don't think it will. Will it eventually cost them viewers? I think so, and I hope so. I talk to a lot of WWF fans here, and lately it's been me who hosts the pay-per-view parties, and not a single person has ever had anything to say about the Ministry. Nothing positive, nothing negative, just apathy. So remember to watch Raw, everybody, so you can see the absolute irrefutable proof that Vince McMahon is not a booking genius. Watch as the WWF drops trow and shows us their single worst creation ever. Watch so that the next time a lamest ever thread pops up, you can say with pride of a survivor, 'You think RoboCop was lame? You obviously didn't see the heaping pile of suck. That was the Ministry of Darkness.' It's a shame that the one time the wrestling content on Raw actually comes off smelling like daisies, they have to have manure like this to obscure the pleasing smell." So Ryan was pretty adamant there that he was no fan of the Ministry of Darkness. Danger3210 chimed in, "The Ministry scenes on Raw likely aren't what I have a problem with. This sacrificing Ryan Shamrock will just lead to a Ken Shamrock Undertaker feud. Only thing I have a problem with is when they cross that fine line from over-the-top angle to complete stupidness, like hanging people and making guys drink your blood. Also, I wish The Undertaker could wrestle a good match again, which he has not done for 10 months. I thought Vince screaming into the camera, though, was hilarious." Morpheus27 chimes in, "I was at the taping for Raw at Nassau Coliseum, and believe you me, we all hated watching that stupid angle play out. It's too bad you didn't see the 10 minutes it took for the stagehands to lay the cross out, and then the 5 minutes the wrestlers just hung around, holding the cross waiting for their cues. You would have booed even louder. But, had I seen the Heat interview segment prior to or during the tapings, maybe it would have sat a little bit differently with me. They played a couple of interview segments during the show, but a lot of them were done after the taping, so it was hard to figure out where things were going. Playing up The Undertaker as someone who is living his gimmick a little too strongly is the way to go. The thing is, cracks have to start to show in the Ministry for it to work better. The Brood leaving would be good, starting to show, chinks in the armor here. Since the Brood is wasted anyway, them leaving would be a good thing. I heard Vince McMahon is supposed to face Undertaker at SummerSlam, so maybe by then things will have resolved itself. In any event, I think it's one small step for Vince to turn face down the road. I'm a firm believer in the coup angle, whereby Shane steals the company from his father and tries to run things his way. Thereby, Vince can only turn to one man, Stone Cold." July 27th, 1999, Danger3210 is back with a post titled, "The Undertaker Losing the Supernatural Shit?" and 3 question marks. Not the NWA question mark, actual question marks. He said something about, "No more special effect entrances, just kicking ass now. Does this mean he will be returning to the badass biker guy, which they showed last night on Sunday Night Heat? Even though he is in desperate need of a vacation, I do want to see the badass biker guy return and destroy guys like he used to. Now, what's weird about what I just read to you is that this post referencing badass biker guy, and I hope badass biker guy comes back, this was posted a year before we first saw the American Badass debut at Judgment Day. This post was from July of 1999. American Badass did not debut until May of 2000. Now, I did go back and I watched that episode of Sunday Night Heat that he referenced. That was the pre-fully loaded 99 episode of Heat, the night of the pay-per-view. And we see The Undertaker in the back coming into the building with Paul Bearer. Paul Bearer is just wearing a t-shirt. I mean, his pants are barely... He was in physically just terrible shape at that point. I don't know that I've ever seen Paul Bearer fatter than he was here in this video. And Undertaker walks into the building and he's in his street clothes. So I guess to Danger Man over here, this was the biker version of The Undertaker. That's how he described him. He looked like a biker to people, even though there was no bike. But that was kind of weird. Seeing a bring back badass biker taker reference a whole 10 months before he actually debuted that character on TV. The exact Undertaker quote that he was referencing, by the way, was this. The days of scary music and scary entrances are over. The days of Armageddon are upon us. So Zip replied and said, actually, his most interesting interview would have to be the one where he said, I've crippled more people than polio. I marked out hard for that line. That is a great line. I wish I knew what promo that was from. I vaguely remember that. That actually was a great line. Randomly, I came across, we get away from the Undertaker stuff here now. Randomly, I came across this gem of a post from July 1st, 2000. A post by The Big Crapper, titled RSPW Seems to Have a Size Complex. He says, no, not that kind of size complex, a height and weight complex. People bash the Giants saying that 5'8" guys can clean their clocks. A lot of guys said Kidman could beat Hogan. S.A. Rios could beat The Undertaker. When did people say S.A. Rios could beat The Undertaker? I don't remember hearing that. I mean, maybe S.A. Rios could have beaten up The Undertaker. I mean, some of those guys, look, you heard stories about Junico, right? Junico Sin Cara. You don't want to piss that guy off. He'll throw a soda can at your head. Maybe S.A. Rios had this tough personality I've never heard about before. Anyway, he continues. Unless the little guy is Gracie and is educated in the art of breaking limbs, he's going to get crushed by the bigger guy. I am a skilled trained martial artist and I'm the one telling you this because I know. You would think I'd be telling you size doesn't matter, but in a fight, 99% of the time that is the deciding factor. I just think RSPW has been bullied by big guys and likes to attack them. Sure, it's possible to beat bigger guys, you can kick a guy's knee out quite easily, but you have to know what you're doing and few people do. So while I am not saying that you're wrong in saying that a man of smaller size can beat a bigger man, that is entirely possible, but don't make it sound as if it's always a case where the smaller guy is the odds-on favorite. Okay, so that was The Big Crapper. Now, in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with what he said. He's coming from a place of personal experience, and he's relaying what his thoughts are about the big guy facing the little guy in a fight and all that. Nothing wrong with that. Well, there was some banter back and forth between The Big Crapper and a lady named Molly, who had the line of the week here in her response to something that The Big Crapper said earlier in the thread. She said, see, Mr. Crap, I don't consider being a woman a disadvantage. The fact that you do just demonstrates your short-sightedness. I am a woman who is 5'10" and a competitive kickboxer. I have studied Taekwondo for 10 years. I can bench 250, and I was a runner-up for the Miss Maryland pageant. I only mentioned that last one to demonstrate that my athleticism has not affected my femininity. Plus, I am 20 credits shy of my doctorate, so don't talk down to me. You fear the vagina. Don't be ashamed. Most men are not comfortable enough with their masculinity to accept a strong woman. In fact, unless the woman is docile, 98 pounds, and has an IQ to match her weight, you cower in fear. I pray you never have a daughter. You fear the vagina is not a statement I expected to be reading aloud this week, but here we are. And finally, there is this post, the main entree of the segment this week. Although I don't know how I could ever top vagina fear, but I will try. I wonder if there's a clinical term for that, like a phobia? Vaginophobia, maybe? Labiaphobia? I don't know. This here is a post about the WCW world title from July 7th, 1998, the day after Bill Goldberg pinned Hollywood Hogan on Monday Nitro at the Georgia Dome to win the WCW world title. This is a post from J-Dawg. That's a D-A-W-G. That's the cool way of saying it, I guess. J-Dawg. Now, Goldberg winning the title on free TV instead of a big pay-per-view main event that WCW could have made a lot of money on was always a questionable decision. But putting the title on Goldberg was not because of how damn over he was. It was the right call. J-Dawg didn't seem to think so. This is what he said. Now that Goldberg is the world champion, it's a very exciting time for us fans. Now we get to look forward to Goldberg defending the title against such worthy opponents as Fit Finlay, Disco Inferno, Brian Adams, Vincent, Chavo Guerrero, La Parca, Reese, Canyon, Steve McMichael, Roadblock, Sick Boy, and maybe in 2 or 3 months we'll get all treated to a main event on the biggest Nitro of all time of Goldberg versus Glacier. I tell you, WCW is on a freaking roll. Oh yeah, what does this do to that Hogan versus Bret Hart headliner at Starrcade? I got a better angle. Eric Bischoff gets fired and takes a job at Titan Sports for $20,000 a year. His official position will be Mr. McMahon's bitch. So that was J-Dawg's position on this whole Goldberg winning the world title thing. Clearly he was not a big fan of this. One of the few, I think, who was not a big fan. Not that, and Goldberg had his haters and his detractors, but I would think that most people with common sense would realize that the end result of this Goldberg push was going to be him winning the world title because he was super over. There's no denying that. You don't have to like Goldberg to know that the guy was the most popular guy on the WCW roster. So that was from J-Dawg, and we end with this reply to J-Dawg's post. You're right. They should have kept the title on Hogan. They should have pissed off the 30,000 or so fans who bought tickets to the Georgia Dome to see Goldberg win. They should have kept the title on Hogan so that we get a title match perhaps once every 3 months on Nitro. Face it, both guys suck in the ring. Right now, Goldberg is more over than Hogan is. A long-term Goldberg reign is probably not a great idea. But who knows? Putting the belt on him at Nitro was the right thing to do for business at that moment in time. Many of you may not think that is the case. All you need to do is go to a house show and talk to all the marks and ask them who the man is. They're going to tell you it's Goldberg. And the marks are at least 80 to 90% of the total wrestling audience, and they're the people that pay money, buy the pay-per-views, buy the shirts, etc. Some of you are going to say, no way, there are a lot more smart fans than 10 or 20% of the audience. Right. How many times have you gone to a house show and really talked to somebody who knows what the hell they're talking about? Every time I go to a show, I see 500,000 marks and about 5 or 10 guys who are surrounded by a big crowd and telling everybody about the inside story about how he heard Scott Hall's been off television because he's been talking to Nash about how to get the Wolfpack back together and all that. Many people here on the internet have this inflated sense of how many smart fans there really are watching wrestling. Several times today, people wrote Nitro sucked, but it's probably going to win because it went up against the taped Raw. I'm afraid the live tape thing has done nothing whatsoever with the ratings. If you look at back at the ratings, taped Raws have actually done better than live Raws on average over the past couple of years. This is not to say that every taped Raw does better than a live show. People seem to think that the majority of wrestling fans in the world get taping results before they before the shows air. This is not the case. Probably 3 to 4% of the total audience for Raw and Nitro this week knew the Raw taping results. I also heard Goldberg will be shitty as champion because none of the top guys are going to want a job to him. Therein lies the real problem with WCW right now. How many top guys have jobbed to Hogan lately? How many top guys have jobbed to Sting lately? How many top guys have jobbed to anyone lately? The top guys don't like to do jobs in WCW. They bitch, they moan, they tear out their knees, they pull a muscle in their back. Whatever they can think of to get out of doing a job. And for a long time, WCW has allowed them to do that. Goldberg is going to work as a champion for the first time, being because the marks are apeshit for him. To them, he's the man. Whether a long-term Goldberg reign can be successful depends on how WCW books him. Right now, WCW has basically destroyed Hogan as champion for the time being, and they did it long before Goldberg beat him. He's been beaten clean and resorted to outside interference finishes so much that nobody takes him seriously anymore. This loss on Nitro certainly did not help, but people who say that Hogan's credibility is killed because he jobbed to a rookie are missing the point. Doesn't matter if Goldberg is a rookie. To the marks, he's an enormous monster who just kicked everyone's ass left and right and made him unstoppable. To the vast majority of paying wrestling fans, Hogan's loss to Goldberg was probably less of a blow to him than it had to be to Randy Savage or Roddy Piper or even Kevin Nash. A long-term Goldberg reign will fail if WCW continues to allow the top guys to get out of doing jobs to him. Feeding top guys like Scott Hall and Kurt Hennig and Lex Luger and Sting to Goldberg won't kill them. In fact, feeding nobodies to Goldberg won't kill him for a while because he's beaten pretty much nobody since his debut, and he's still over like crazy. What WCW needs to do is tell the Hennigs and the Nashes and WCW to get their fat, lazy asses into the ring and do what's right for business. Nobody ever told Nash he was going to have to be the new Red Rooster. They just told him he had to do a job. Some of you may not like Goldberg. You may think he's a bad worker. You may think he doesn't sell enough. You may think he's green. It's easy to throw insider terms around and act like you know what's best for WCW or WWF. But all the insider fans here on the internet make up 5% of WCW, WWF, and ECW's total revenue. So truthfully, what you think means jack to them most of the time. The bottom line is this. Goldberg is over. He's selling tickets. He's selling t-shirts. He's helping draw ratings. 99% of the Georgia Dome and probably 90 to 95% of the folks watching on TV wanted him to win that damn belt from Hogan. It was the right move to give him the belt, and whomever said that half of you would have bitched no matter what happened could not have been more right. The author of that reply that I just read was Brian Alvarez, who then goes on to plug his Figure Four Weekly. Says, send me your name and home address. Please do not send your email address as this is not an email sheet. And I'll send you 2 free issues. Gotta get that plug there, there at the very end. And so this has been your weekly reminder that you never knew back then who might be lurking on RSPW. This week's sad tweet comes from the reigning, although not for much longer, Ring of Honor, Women of Honor champion, Kelly Klein, who Saturday morning tweeted, still going to support the amazing talent, and she included a screenshot showing that the official Ring of Honor account has blocked her on Twitter. Ring of Honor blocked its own women's champion on Twitter. If Tom Petty had a brother, it would be Ring of Honor. How petty can you be? On a happier note, we have what I am terming our very first sweet tweet, or tweets, of the week. I know a lot of you have been following along. Some of you may not have any idea that any of this is even going on. One of our listeners actually got this whole thing started. He had tweeted something to Dana Brooke, letting her know that she should date Dave Batista. Dave Batista is newly single. I don't know what happened with his girlfriend or fiance or whatever she was, but he is newly single. And so this whole thing has started, and it's been going on now for at least a week, of back and forth on Twitter between Dana Brooke and Dave Batista. And everybody is following along. They find this, and I agree, I find this more interesting than the Bobby Lashley Rusev stuff on TV. This budding romance between Batista and Dana Brooke. Now I'm sure, if I had to take a guess, they've been DMing each other saying, listen, play along. Let's really play this up and just make this entertaining. But you never know. You never know with these things. Hey, Batista and Dana Brooke may have little Batista babies one of these days. So it's been kind of fun to follow along. She'll make a comment. He'll come back with a comment of his own. He's posting pictures of himself, and she's posting pictures of herself. It's actually kind of fun to follow along. Now I want to see it culminate in some kind of a date that gets filmed, like a reality show. Remember that old TV show, Blind Date? It was like a syndicated show. Roger Lodge. Remember Roger Lodge was the host? I used to love that shit. I don't think it's on the air anymore. They had Blind Date. They had one called The Fifth Wheel. We need like a Blind Date type episode with Batista and Dana Brooke. So the gimmick on the show was, you have these people, they're on a blind date, obviously, no shit, and they have these pop-up bubbles. Now maybe the show is scripted, maybe it was all bullshit looking back on it, I don't know. But they would have little pop-up bubbles about what the person was thinking. It was really funny. We really need something like that with Batista and Dana Brooke. But this is the romance that nobody expected, and has been very entertaining throughout the week on social media. Where it goes, like I said, I think it's all just a put-on between them, but stranger things have happened. You might have little Dana Batista babies running around before long. You could thank one of our listeners for getting the ball rolling on that. You could make him the godfather of the baby. Let's take a couple of mailbag questions and we'll wrap up here. You could always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I did get a sound-off inbox, a brand new video inbox up on the YouTube channel last week. Over 40 minutes answering your questions, so if you missed it, if you want to watch it, go back on the YouTube channel. It's a YouTube exclusive. Go back and check it out. Brandon from Chicago. It's how many wrestling shows last week in Chicago, right? Was SmackDown in Chicago? No, Raw was in Chicago. NXT TakeOver, Survivor Series, Raw, AEW Dynamite. We have to get at least one question in from somebody in Chicago. This one comes from Brandon. The opinion on the Jim Cornette NWA situation seemed pretty split to me. Does this surprise you? No, not at all. Not at all. Everybody has their own opinion. He's also got his cult followers who are going to defend him to the death no matter what he says or does. So I'm not surprised. I knew what to expect when I took my Cornette clip from last week's podcast and I posted it to the YouTube channel. A lot of people really showed their ass in that comment section. And look, I'm cool with people who disagreed with me and felt Cornette should not have had to apologize and he should have stayed, or he could have, you know, he could have resolved it in other ways without him having to leave the show. Everybody has their own view on it. Voiced in a rational way, I got no problem with you. I got no beef with you. But there were a lot of people who showed their ass. You're a cuck. You're a homo. You're this. You're that. I didn't know Solomonster was this or that. One person, sent a death threat into me. The usual bottom of the barrel, lowest common denominator type stuff from scum that you would expect. The ones who love to throw around the word snowflake, for example, like they're the ones who often have absolutely nothing of any real value at all to add to a conversation, so that's what they fall back on. They fall back to those certain words because they have nothing better to say, so they hide behind them. They have no real argument. And then you have the others who just throw petty insults at me, again, because they have nothing of any real value to say. So it's not surprising at all. A lot of people really expose themselves badly on this one, and they missed a bigger point of the clip, which is less about racism or what his intent was or wasn't. The bigger point was simply that his employer felt the need to apologize for him on two different occasions in the span of a month. So he had to go. This was not going to work out. You have to part ways. Plain and simple. Either by his own choice, or you make the choice for him. He is his own worst enemy. I'm sure he must have seen this coming. He must have expected it to happen at some point. That's just the way it goes. Terry from Florence, South Carolina. I've noticed that guys like, or the guys that Carmella has dated, Big Cass and Corey Graves, are complete assholes. My question for you is, does Carmella have a thing for assholes? Well, that can mean multiple things, and so I'm not even going to touch that one. I'll just let that hang out there. And lastly here, I got a question from KW from Milwaukee. Ian from Chicago had asked me a similar question. Shout out to Ian. A few years ago, I decided to get Netflix because of your high praise for the service, and I love it. Have you had a chance to check out the series titled The Toys That Made Us? The recent season has an episode about pro wrestling toys. I did watch the wrestling episode, and I really liked it. It's a documented history of wrestling figures, including the old WCW Galoob figures and the WWF LJN figures. Not only did I have those LJNs, and I still have a whole bunch of them, I remember buying one of those WCW Galoob figures. I think it was one of the Galoob ones. It was this oversized Hollywood Hogan NWO figure. I mean, it wasn't as oversized as the LJN ones, but it was bigger than like what you would see with the current action. Whenever I see one of these WWF figures or WWE figures in like a CVS or something, this was bigger than that. And it was this Hollywood Hogan figure. It had a red button in his side that when you would push it, it would make him vibrate. So, and I'm ashamed to admit that I basically owned a Hulk Hogan vibrator. That's basically what it was. I don't know what the point of it was. I'm still not really sure after all these years what the freaking point of that red button was. But in any event, I did own it. I don't think I have. Maybe I still have it. Maybe it's in the closet somewhere. I don't know. I don't remember throwing it away. I'll tell you what. If I find it, I will definitely take a picture of it, and I might even vibrate it. Which is kind of weird to say, but may as well, if it even works. I don't know if it's battery operated or what. But anyway, I still remember that. I did buy that. I don't know why, but I did. It's a good thing it didn't spout off any catchphrases when you press that red button. There's no telling what would have come out of Hogan's mouth. There's a spinoff series on Netflix right now. So if you enjoy The Toys That Made Us, they made a new one called The Movies That Made Us, which is narrated by the same person. I think it's the same people who did the other series. I just watched the Die Hard episode. They have a whole bunch of them. Die Hard, Ghostbusters, Dirty Dancing. I forgot the other ones. But the Die Hard one, because I'm a huge Die Hard fan, that one was really fun. And I did not know this before, but the last stunt in the movie where Alan Rickman falls from the top of Nagatomi Tower, they dropped Rickman down about... It was really him in the stunt, even if you couldn't see his face or whatever when you see the body and everything. Like, they used him to do the stunt. He fell 40 feet down onto this giant inflatable pad, which they show with the blue pad behind him in the documentary. They told him, look, we're going to count down from 3, 2, 1, and then you're going to drop. Okay, so that's what he was expecting. Instead, they counted 3, 2, and they dropped him on 1 because they wanted to get a more genuine reaction. So it turns out the look of sheer terror on his face in that scene, one of the last scenes of the movie, was real because he wasn't ready for the drop. But Die Hard is one of my favorite all-time movies. I was just talking to somebody about this yesterday at like a Thanksgiving dinner. It almost doesn't matter if I happen to be, and I don't watch a lot of television where I'm flipping these days. I just don't watch that much TV. But if I am, and I happen to be flipping around to one of the movie channels, and Die Hard is on, pretty much always. That doesn't matter what part of the movie it's at, end, beginning, unless I just have something else to do. I always stop and I watch the movie. From that point on, I finish the film. It's just one of those movies. And Die Hard is indeed the ultimate Christmas movie. I don't care what Bruce Willis says or what anybody else says. This debate was settled long ago. Die Hard is, in fact, a Christmas movie. And one of the greatest movies ever made. So, you can email me your questions if you have any other things you'd like to ask about. TheSolemonster@gmail.com. As we barrel through the remainder of the holiday season, I do want to mention here that my mother's children's book, The Adventure of Hardy the Horse, it had been out of stock on Amazon. It is now back in stock. And it actually is a great stocking stuffer for the holidays. If you have a young child, anywhere really between the ages of 4 to 8, but really any young child, whether they're your child or if it's a relative or a friend's kid, it's a great stocking stuffer, a great holiday gift. I hope you'll all consider picking up a copy, either for them or for yourself. Again, it's The Adventure of Hardy the Horse. It is available on Amazon.com. And when you order the book, you can also leave a review, which is very helpful for the book as well. And it's in hardcover form. There's also an ebook version. hardcover. You can't really replicate that hardcover, though, holding it in your hand. I love the colors, the vibrancy of the color. I'm really happy with how it all came out. That is a holiday gift idea. For those of you wondering what to get someone very small and very young, hopefully you will consider picking up a copy of Hardy the Horse for them. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. That is my handle, as many of you are already aware. You can vote in our polls every single week. We get a Raw poll up, a SmackDown poll up, AEW, NXT. You can let your voice be heard and vote in those polls when they go up each and every week. I love polls. I got plenty of polls. Plenty of polls. And it's not very hard, either, you know, to vote in these polls. Polls are not that hard. Anyway, I will be back next weekend, episode 629 of The Sound Off, and I'll be back this Wednesday live on YouTube after AEW Dynamite for another live stream as well, so join me there. It's around 10 p.m. Eastern. So until then, be well, stay safe. Hopefully everybody enjoyed their Thanksgiving. It's back to work on Monday. That sucks, but hey, that's the way it goes. And I will see you back here for a brand new episode next weekend. Until then, arrivederci.
The Solomonster sounds off.
I saw so many people salty.
Killian Dane used the one-winged angel.
Oh, they're trying to upstage Kenny Omega. They're firing a shot at AEW.
Dane has used this move before. They called it the Ulster Plantation.
But my God, the comments that I saw.
This is a shot at AEW.
Are you fucking kidding me? Like, calm down.
Calm down.
Calm down.
Calm down.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.